If Skywalker returns, the new Jedi will rise.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, Star Wars Retrospective Series.
There's been an awakening. Have you felt it?
Join Garrett.
He means nothing to me.
Matt.
Okay, stay calm.
I am calm.
I'm talking to myself.
And Adam.
I'm not giving you anything.
We'll see.
As they review each film in the Star Wars saga. From George Lucas's original trilogy.
Chewie, we're home.
All the way through the Disney sequels and side stories.
This is very complicated.
The boys will look at each film individually and decide how this popular film series holds up.
Good to see you!
Search Your Feelings, podcast listeners.
Don't be afraid, I feel it too.
The Percolated Media Star Wars Retrospective begins now.
Chewie, come on!
Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, released December 18, 2015. Budget on this was $447 million, with a box office of $2.071 billion, with a B. And this was directed by J.J. Abrams. Before we get to the release of this, I do have to go back 3 years. I had started working at ABC Disney. I was there 10 days, and my boss called me into the office. I had just started as a news segment producer, and my boss had called us all into a huge board meeting to tell us that Disney had just bought Star Wars, and my mind was blown. I could not believe it was going to be another Hans. Let's put it that way. Adam, you knew me around that time. We were back to being buds around that time. What were you thinking when they announced, yeah, Disney had just bought Star Wars?
I don't believe it. And I remember us going, wow. It's just, what? Why? But then Lucas came up pretty quick and explained his reasonings and his thought process. And I was like, you know what? Good for George. Good for him to go out on his way. Good for him on seeing a company that could do something with it in the way that he would want to. But also deciding that he was going to ride off into the sunset, fund projects he wanted to fund. I mean, the fact that he gave away like half of the money that he netted from this sale, what he's done for colleges down in Southern California for film, and up here in Northern California to preserve the natural order, the natural landscape and stuff. I was happy for him because he took so much shit for the prequels. It's almost, you know, those movies and Star Wars in general is almost like a presidency. Trying to give them their proper due in the time frame they're released is almost impossible. You almost have to have hindsight, and they all get reevaluated. They all have new thoughts later. But I did feel it was the right decision if they were going to continue to make it, because I feel like the fans just really sucked the joy out of George Lucas.
Yeah, we had people versus George Lucas. We mentioned that when we did the prequels. There were a lot of shots taken at him, and not to mention people in the press. And then by this time, you know, I was reviewing movies. A lot of people were making huge article statements about, you know, how George Lucas, and I hate this phrase, but it came out around this time, what, quote-unquote, raped their childhood. It was a terrible, terrible place to be for him emotionally, but financially, the guy was fine, and he had gathered Carrie, he had gathered Mark, he had gathered Harrison, all in a room, and he said he had ideas for Episode 7. And what he was going to do was he was going to use the equity that he made off of it, go to Disney and say, I am interested in selling now. You guys can do what you want with this, but here's my first episode. It is still viable. Now it can be sold. But Bob Iger came at him with a pretty big proposition that George Lucas could not refuse, to the point where it got bought for $4 billion. Yes, billion dollars. And as Adam said, Lucas ended up giving half of that away anyway. Matt, what were you thinking when Disney had bought Star Wars?
So I was more surprised at the notion of Lucas selling as opposed to someone buying it. I always thought that this would be something that Lucas took to his grave. And when I heard that they had bought Star Wars, I sort of looked at it as the second domino to fall, the first one being when Disney bought Marvel a couple years before this. I think that was like 2009.
Something
like that. I'm not surprised that Disney would be the one conglomerate to purchase it, because, look, even in 2012 when this went down, the studio system was better than it is now, but we've seen quite a few fold in the decades since. So they were the only one that realistically could do it. And then I had two thoughts. The optimistic voice in my head, I sort of had the angel and the devil on both sides of my head. On the positive side, new Star Wars for a new generation for movies. I thought that was cool. On the negative side, it was just the idea of this is going to be the first time where George Lucas basically has no involvement or as minimal involvement as he has ever had. This is effectively handing off your child. He's basically the Obi-Wan handing Luke to Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru and basically saying, you know, unlike Obi-Wan, I'm not going to be here to protect him necessarily. So do with it what you will. So when I looked at everything, it was more of Lucas giving it up than Disney buying it. That was the more surprising part for me.
And the funny thing is, they did retain him because when they were getting ready to make this, it didn't take long. About a few days after this, they had announced that, yeah, we're going to be doing three new movies. It's not just going to be one. And then a little after that, they said that they're going to do a movie a year. We'll get to that more when we talk about Rogue One next week. But George Lucas had treatments. Like I said, he had stuff outlined. By this point, J.J. Abrams was hired. I'll get to how he was hired here in a bit. And everyone gathered in a room. J.J., Kathleen Kennedy, and Lucas, they gathered in a room and they went over these story ideas and J.J. rejected them. And J.J. went ahead and he brought in Lawrence Kasdan, who worked on Raiders of the Lost Ark, and of course he worked on Empire Strikes Back. Yes, George Lucas was fired by J.J. Abrams, which is funny to say to this day. But J.J. Abrams,
part of that deal was the story treatments that he wrote were sold along with the company. So whether it was misleading or he was just looking at the cup half full or three quarters full, those stories were part of the sale. And then for them, Disney to go, fuck it, never mind. He made some comments later that were just like, damn, like the bloom was off the rose really fast.
Yeah, he did. And I'll get to his reaction to the film in a bit. But let's get to J.J. Abrams. J.J. Abrams was recommended to Kathleen Kennedy by Steven Spielberg. He had just worked with him a couple years before on Super 8. And, of course, J.J. Abrams, and we'll get to this next year. I know Matt's aching to talk about it, but he had just resurrected Star Trek a few years before. So Kathleen Kennedy called him up, and J.J. Abrams turned her down. He turned her down three times because, as he said, he didn't want the pressure of what being the director of the new Star Wars brought. And my God, in the year since, I could definitely see where he was coming from. But somehow, someway, I don't know if they added a zero to the check or not, they got him to come on board. Matt, I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to say, but Adam, what were you thinking when they hired J.J. Abrams to helm this thing?
Me, it was the news story of, oh my goodness, you're crossing the streams of putting Trek in Wars and Wars in Trek, and oh my goodness. But like I said, when we previewed our thoughts on this, I enjoyed the reboot of Star Trek. Was it 2009?
Yep.
Did I finally get that right for once? So I was down to have him do this as much as anybody. I'm not big on JJ one way or the other. I've not seen Super 8. I was not against it whatsoever. And when it came to it, I had no idea who I would choose instead. So if anything, it felt like Disney was being safe. But I was okay with that to start off. You know, I felt like, hey, get the franchise back in front of fans, and then we'll see where we go from there.
News is coming out, and I was on the cusp of like thinking, I think this is bullshit. I don't think he actually got hired. And I remember the guy who was running the Amigo site that we were working for at the time, he was like, I'm going to go ahead and post this. I said, dude, it might be a hoax. I don't think so. Eventually it did. It was brought out by more than one reliable source that, yes, it was J.J. Abrams who was brought on board. Matt, what were you thinking when J.J. Abrams was brought on board to a series that you yourself have said you don't have too much heart invested into?
I don't. And that same logic applies to how J.J. Abrams treated Star Trek, because he outright said he was not a Star Trek fan. Basically pulled a Tim Burton with Batman, but yet made a Star Trek movie. And it's very fitting because he made a Star Trek movie that is Star Trek in name only. He made a Star Wars type movie under the guise of Star Trek. We'll get into the movies when we actually cover them, but a lot of my, it's not hatred for Abrams, because unlike a Brett Ratner or some of these other directors who I just think are scumbags, I have nothing personal against J.J. Abrams, but I always thought he used Star Trek as leverage to get this job and basically said, damn that property, I'm just going to use it as a stepping stone, put my own spin on it, make a Star Wars movie and use that to, who knows, maybe actually get Star Wars. So I understand he declined it, but I think that was more of a publicity move on his part to give himself unlimited power, to quote Palpatine. Granted, part of a big Imperial Senate room of people involved in this production, but I can't lie. When he was announced, I rolled my eyes. I was not happy. I was not impressed either. I thought there were some other choices I would have vastly preferred that were thrown out there, but it would have been a hard sell for me for a new Star Wars movie, 100%, regardless of who directed it.
All right, so movie goes into production. There was a picture that was released that I actually really enjoyed. It's like the table read, the first table read they ever did with R2-D2 in the background, and I love that picture. And the marketing was starting off right away, boys, and...
Well, that, not to cut you off, but that, I think that's a good place to start when the cast was announced. Obviously, we knew part of the deal was you were going to get your mainstays back, Mark Hamill, all the way down. But I looked at the list of new actors. I really appreciated that they did not, even with Disney and the most recognizable IP in the world, they still didn't feel the need to pepper this with A-list stars. Like, there's not a Tom Cruise in here or, you know, like a Robert Downey Jr. They cast some recognizable names, but in large part, I didn't feel like anyone was cast where I said they're quote-unquote too big for this. So I liked everything.
Well, yeah, that was a J.J. Abrams call because Disney wanted to go A-list. Abrams had seen Attack the Block, which is a phenomenal movie if people haven't seen it yet. I showed Jen a couple years ago. She loved it. And they wanted a huge star for Rey. But Abrams said, look, Lucas, when he went and got Mark Hamill, when he went and got Carrie Fisher, they were hardly anybody's, so I want to go the same route. And they picked up this Daisy Ridley, who had done one walk-on in a British play. That was her acting credit before she nailed the gig of being the mainstay of this film. So yeah, you're right. They went lower end, and that's part of the person you hate on this production.
Well, and I think he did the same thing he did, though, when he cast Star Trek. His 09 movie. Chris Pine was in what? Alpha Dog and Smokin' Aces? That was basically it. The funniest thing was, I love how this came out the same year as Ex Machina, which has both Oscar Isaac and Domhnall Gleeson.
Yeah. I thought the marketing of this was really good. I mean, Matt, you and I, we've talked a lot about how we haven't felt marketing in the films that we've covered this year was that very good. Did you think the marketing for this was okay?
Oh, it definitely did its job of both reestablishing, they should have called it Star Wars Episode 7, Hey, We're Back, Bitches, because that's really what the first trailer was. I don't think it's on the level of Phantom Menace, in large part because there were so many other big movies in 2015. Star Wars was certainly A, but you can make an argument Age of Ultron was just as anticipated because you were following up the Avengers. I thought that's some really good marketing, too. But the first trailer, I wasn't enamored with the first trailer. I thought the second one, when it ends with, you know, Han and Chewie, I wasn't super excited, though. I didn't think it looked bad. But there was nothing I was seeing in the trailers that was really gripping me from I didn't see, okay, it's 30 years, what's going to rope me back into this world? And truthfully, I didn't see that. I saw Harrison Ford, I'm like, okay, he showed up to set. I think you see one shot of Carrie Fisher, and I turned, when the trailer came out, I said, where the fuck is Mark Hamill? That was my biggest question, because of the three, he was the only one I wanted to see come back. Of your main three. Something about Harrison Ford from 2005 to 2015, the exception of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which we talked about, he really came back for and gave it his all, and I know he likes that character a lot more than Han Solo. That kind of gave me some concern.
Also was shocked by not seeing Mark Hamill, but I thought they were keeping him on complete lockdown and putting him with a personal trainer for 2 years before this movie came out. Look, I appreciate Mark Hamill as a voice actor. I think he's completely underrated that way. He's not a good actor in live action, in anything that he's been in. And he had let himself physically go the way that not many people would hire him to put him on screen. So that's what I thought Disney was doing. Some people felt the same way about Carrie Fisher. I don't. What I was taken about right away was they were also introducing us to some of the new things. There was a lot of, oh my god, look at that lightsaber, it's venting out the sides. Oh my god, look at this droid, it's something completely different and badass. Oh my god, there's a black stormtrooper, what the? And you know what, you know when internet false racism hate started was the first time that you saw Finn pop up out of the sand. Like, yeah. you could trace a lot of the way people talk on the internet now to that moment. But I thought it was good. I thought it was well done. Like Matt, I don't think it holds a candle to The Phantom Menace. I still think that is probably the high point of marketing and trailers, period, especially that first one and that first image on the first one-sheet poster. But it did its job, especially to somebody like me, who grew up with the originals, went to see the prequels when he was in high school and out of high school, or just out of high school, and now had a family that he was going to take to go see his heroes back on the silver screen. But it wasn't just me. My family was as excited as they could be. And to have a child, my daughter, my oldest, see Rey and know that she was going to be the headline of this, holy hell. Do you have any idea how much Rey merchandise was bought in this house? No figures or dolls, because Disney fucked that marketing dog.
They didn't come
out of the frickin' board game, but t-shirts and things like that.
Yeah, Monopoly, they left her out.
So they did the same thing to Black Widow for Winter Soldier, but t-shirts and things like that was rocked in this house because she was all about Rey. And that made me excited because there was somebody new that for her.
You know what I thought? The reason they were holding Luke out of the marketing was because he was going to be the one behind the Black Woman.
I know, that was a lot of discussion. Yeah.
Well, look, when this movie was announced, the fan theories began to infest the internet. And that was a common, if Luke was not Kylo Ren necessarily, like underneath the mask, he at least would have been the big villain of the trilogy. Part of that, I think, is also because Mark Hamill has played the Joker and, you know, Fire Lord Ozai, so it would be something different for him. But I never thought, because I saw fucking Kylo Ren, I'm like, there's no way that's Mark Hamill. Just looking at the body type, that's not him.
Well, I didn't know until I walked in. You know, they told us that Adam Driver was the villain, but they tell us a lot of things.
JJ and his, you know, his patented history.
Exactly.
Mystery box.
Yeah. Which they really weren't. That was not part of the marketing, really. I will give them credit for that. There was no, who's the big villain? Or in the marketing, there wasn't this big, like, where is Luke? Which is really what the movie's about. That was not hinted at in the trailers.
It could have been. Mm-hmm. It easily could have been the hunt for Luke Skywalker.
So, the premiere for this, I went to it. Red carpet premiere. It was an amazing experience. I got to see JJ. I got to see Lucas. He was there. I got to see Steven Spielberg, all of them in the same vicinity, which was just an amazing experience. It was cool to be amongst all of that. But despite those surroundings, I came out of that screening. And I don't know, Adam, if I text you first. I came out of it. I don't want to say overwhelmed. I don't want to say underwhelmed. Just whelmed. You know, like, it was fine. You know, I didn't feel huge one way or the other. And I remember letting one of the guys who ran the site that we worked at before, I remember texting him. So it was an exciting experience to experience a Star Wars movie, but I just remember just feeling really flat and numb about it. Adam, you took your family. It must have been a joyous occasion. What were you feeling when you came out of Star Wars The Force Awakens the first time?
It's funny, you text me, and I remember exactly what you text. That's the funny part. And I felt kind of similar. Like, I remember walking out going, man, they brought something to this. They did this, and I need to see it again. It wasn't as long as it was between Return of the Jedi and Phantom Menace, but it sure felt longer. And maybe it's because of the change of companies and my age and everything else. But it felt like this was the first one in 20 years, and it wasn't. Close, but, and there had been, you know, Star Wars media since. That first experience was just kind of take it in, and then I knew I was going to have to see it again to really get it fleshed out. But it was a sensory bombardment of everything, where, much like a lightsaber to the chest, it's kind of hard to take it all in one shot. You know, you almost have to go back and reevaluate.
Matt, what about you?
I came out of it, and I remember saying, for the life of me, I don't remember who I saw it with, but I said, it was fine. I think that I came out of it like most people came out of Phantom Menace, where I'm like, yeah, was what it was. I enjoyed it. It's one of those movies that really benefited from being in the theater. I can't imagine if I watched this at home, I would have had the same atmosphere, certainly. But yeah, for something that was the same amount of time between this and Phantom Menace as Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi, the response was nowhere near as outraged or as really divisive as Phantom Menace was. Everyone saw it. Everyone said, yeah, it was fine. And then that was basically it. The discourse kind of came and went, which is weird for a movie that made over $2 billion.
People went back to see it a number of times, obviously. You don't cross the $2 billion mark by people not going back. But I think it was just the fact that Star Wars was back. You know, me and Adam said it. It was a really cool buildup. It was really good marketing. I loved seeing Harrison Ford on the talk show circuit talking about it. But when I came out of it, I remember thinking that this was built up as a massive event, right? That we were going to get a new Star Wars movie. But when I came out of it, I remember saying to the person I was with, I told her, I said, you know what? In the end, it's just a movie. And that's how I felt too. And you know who else was underwhelmed, boys? Was George Lucas. He went to the premiere, and what he said was he felt going to this movie was kind of like going to your ex-wife's wedding. That's what he compared it to. Which I think is a brilliant comparison. And when he came out of it initially, he said, you know what, that was very enjoyable, I enjoyed it, but I don't know if the press got to him or if the fact that this was made without his heavy involvement got to him. But he came out later, Matt, as you mentioned, and he did not have very nice things to say about it.
No, he certainly didn't. I think he was probably the most vocal critic. Because I don't remember, trying to go back, this one did not have any sort of vocal backlash outside of the New Hope Redux. I think that was from the detractors, that was the big complaint. Not that it was a bad movie, but it just had, you know, a lot in common with Episode 4. It's funny, of the three of this trilogy, I think this one had the least divisive reaction, certainly, when it came to post-release discourse.
That's a good point. Adam, how do you feel about the Lucas reaction to this thing?
I think it was understandable. You know, I mean, it's the first one that he really didn't have anything to do with. I mean, even in Empire and Jedi, he's involved immensely. On this one, Disney said, hey, thanks, we're going to bring you, hey, is that ink dry? No, but it's signed. Okay. Hey, George, go get coffee. We're going to shut the door behind you. So as soon as they got the rights to it and they realized that, hey, for $4 billion, we're about to earn and market this thing and earn ourselves 20 times that amount, they showed him the door. And I understand him kind of being a little put off by that, especially when he thought his story treatments were at least going to get used and they were thrown out like a lightsaber over a cliff.
Well, so what you're saying, they did to George Lucas, like in Death to Smoochie, when they throw the ball outside of the office and we're not going to get it and they shut the door behind us.
All right, let's get to the movies. We open up not with a Disney arch, like what was built up. I remember, Adam, you and I had these discussions. Are they going to do the Disney arch before Star Wars? And Bob Iger came out and said, you know what, out of respect for George, we're going to open up with Lucasfilm. We're not going to do the Disney arch.
There was also are they going to do the fanfare? Oh my God, what's going to happen with the fanfare? And it's funny because that's another discussion that's still being had today. I like the way this was done. I like the Lucasfilm logo. And I was in a theater where everybody was whisper quiet until that logo came up. And then it was like, oh. And then the logo faded and the cheering started. And then when the fanfare hit, or the actual theme hit, the place fucking erupted. Like it was just Mardi Gras, tits out, beats out. I mean, the place went nuts.
It was like Phantom Menace all over again at this point. We get the Long Time Ago in a Galaxy Far, Far Away and the Star Wars logo plastered on the screen as we get another crawl. A crawl that, you know what, I'll say is my favorite so far. It's to the point. It does exactly what it needs to do. It tells us that Luke has vanished and that Leia is out to find him. Boom. That's it. Matt, how do you feel about this opening crawl?
I like that it was straightforward and to the point without being off-putting, with one exception. I guess we'll get into this now. So, 30 years have passed since Return of the Jedi, and fascism just came back. I guess Abrams was being prophetic when it came to Trump, but I was like, okay, so we defeated the Empire only for a new Empire to somehow come back with little to no explanation.
Yep, if you want to find that out, read the books.
Yeah, and to which I say to all of you who will tell me that, I don't have time or the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and says, I'm going to do the whole few good men speech now before I stop. So.
We pan down to a planet as something resembling a Star Destroyer moves across the screen, and we're seeing stormtroopers in line for battle. I have to get something off my chest right now. I'm glad John Williams is back for consistency. But God, I am not a fan of his new themes, and the only time this score works for me is when it evokes old ones. Matt, I know you're not big on music. Adam, how do you feel about Williams' score in this?
I think when Williams brings back his iconic themes, I think they're absolutely fantastic. I think when he creates something new, I think that it is lackluster, and I have the feeling he didn't want to come back for this one. I think he has wanted to work since. I feel like this one, he really just went through the motions. But I also feel like JJ was upset that little crybaby didn't get his Giacchino wish It's fine, but it is, even with 7 movies in, the most underwhelming of all the scores. It's not bad, but it doesn't evoke a lot of emotion out of me.
Matt, do you have an opinion one way or the other on the score?
I think Ray's theme is fantastic, but that's the only memorable piece in this entire compilation of new stuff. This kind of reminds me a lot of his Dial of Destiny score, where a lot of it I view as just
filler. We see BB-8 roll from the screen as Max von Sydow. Far from getting the devil out of a little girl, hands who will learn is Poe Dameron, a map which leads to Luke's location. Now, this was originally supposed to be Wedge Antilles, is what I read. And the guy playing Wedge was like, you know, I don't like that. So he turned it down. So we're getting this person who Leia has supposedly known for years and years to be Max von Sydow.
All right, can we start the tally right now of actors who are wasted in this trilogy? Because this is an emphatic first one to start with. Let's start with Max von Sydow. I think it's cool that he's in Star Wars because he was such a legend. But because this plot point is only here to administer a plot point and he's not a character, it just feels, I don't want to say disrespectful, but you could have done a lot more. You had him there. This could have been anybody. And who is Wedge Antilles to say that's not good enough for me? I get he's Ewan McGregor's uncle, but that's like his only other big credit.
I know. What is he doing turning down a paycheck like this?
So, what I like seeing Max von Sydow here, I was surprised as all hell. I was just like, whoa. And, you know, I expected more out of this role because of who it was. But based on the opening crawl that we got, I expected Wedge to be here. Because when you talk about the best pilot in the Resistance, there's two choices you have. Luke Skywalker, but he's missing, or Wedge Antilles. The only fighter pilot with 2 Death Stars on the whole of his X-Wing. Yes, I'm a fucking nerd. So, I don't know if it was Lawson who decided he didn't want to come back, but this change is weird because you're introducing us to this badass fighter pilot who we don't know. And yes, you want to introduce new characters, but this movie is a, hey, remember this, remember that. So to start it with this is weird because you're introducing us right off the bat with nobody we know, but you told us how important they are. It's just a weird start. I don't mind it. I do think, and I'll say this right here, I do think Oscar Isaac is phenomenal. I think he is an amazing and inspired casting choice.
We see a battle take place. And is it just me, or does the action in this movie seem, I don't know, a bit restrained?
Well, I've never felt J.J., because, like, you go back to Mission Impossible 3, I can't remember a single set piece from that movie. I honestly can't. And then his Star Trek movies are either just big explosive fireworks shows or a shitty fist fight to end a Star Trek movie, because that's what people really came to see. It's Spock beating the shit out of Khan on the top of a flying ship through the streets of wherever the fuck it takes place. Oh, I can't wait to just rip that movie a new one when we get to it. As far as the action in this movie goes, it's not very memorable, which I will give credit for, because when you think about the original trilogy, the action scenes that are there, like some of the big ones, you remember them, but they're never the best parts of the movie, I would say, or the most memorable. So I think that's kind of in line here. Because one of the things that people say about the prequels is that the action scenes are the best part, like the pod race or the Darth Maul fight. So it was kind of a way to not, you know, go down that rabbit hole again.
The action's okay, but I'm struck, and I made a note of it this time, is I feel like they're trying to show that these aren't stormtroopers, they're First Order troopers, because these guys can hit what they shoot at.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Stormtroopers can actually hit.
And I think they're trying to establish them as this malevolent threat by slaughtering this village. I mean, this is pretty, like, Apocalypse Now type shit, coming in with a flamethrower and just toasting this stuff. So it's evocative, but to the point, it's also kind of forgettable. And that's unfortunate when you have these stormtroopers, which, remember, that's taken off of Nazi imagery, just slaughtering this village of people.
Yeah, I mean, this is Nazi imagery mixed with Vietnam, with the, you know, it's an encampment, basically. Yep. That they're burning to the ground, and, you know, I guess it makes sense they're using Nazi imagery, considering how many of these fucking movies have to do with bloodlines.
Poe gets in a ship that gets shot at, so he jumps out, and he sees flamethrowers in effect, as Adam just pointed out, and he puts the map in BB-8. I wonder what we saw this before.
Yeah, stop me if you've heard this, which you can see.
Yeah.
Around the entire 2 hours plus of this movie. I understand that, like, you could certainly view that as a criticism, and I think, to a certain extent, I would agree. But I don't think that should be the whole argument of why this movie is great or why it sucks. I think there's a lot more nuance than people on either side can or could talk about.
And we'll definitely get to all of that. Meanwhile, we see a trooper attend to one of his fallen comrades, who puts a bloody hand on his helmet to tell us that's who we need to pay attention to, and then moves on. Von Cito is captured as we meet our emo villain of the film, Bane. I mean, Kylo Ren.
There is a Darth Bane in Star Wars.
I know. All right. Adam, you could probably answer this more than anybody, but let's get this out of the way. What exactly is the First Order? Is that just the Empire rebuilt?
There's no Empire. Remember that. The Empire was defeated. And see, and this is, we're going to bring it up now. I got a problem with this. The Republic, the New Republic, they are keeping peace throughout the galaxy, but they are so ineffective at what they do that this new First Order, which is fascism reborn, completely come and has taken over to this massive effect that basically they are the size of the Empire in the original trilogy. Like, how worthless is the Republic in trying to keep peace the last 30 years that you let it get to this point?
It's lazy. Yeah, it's, okay, so we defeated the Empire only for Empire fanboy, for all intents and purposes, to restart it. And it makes this new Republic look even worse. And it does the problem, in a lot of ways, this undermines Leia as a leader. That she, under her watch, she and others allowed this to happen to the point where they are the majority. Because we hear about the Resistance, and their resources, much like the Rebels, are significantly smaller and more scarce than what the First Order has. So I had a huge problem with the status quo of this movie, with A, not being brought up to speed on how this happened, why it happened, and B, it's an excuse to have all the returning characters go back to what they were doing previous.
There's no growth. None.
We've had 30 years, but the status quo was stagnant. It's the same thing.
And that was a big reason why, when this episode 7 was announced, I kind of retreated a bit. My excitement wasn't that high, and the reason being was because I thought the end of Return of the Jedi was a fantasy in that everybody lived happily ever after. That was Lucas's reasoning behind doing it that way. Harrison Ford wanted to be killed. We talked about that when we did Return of the Jedi. And George Lucas said, no, I want everybody to live. I want them to live happily ever after. Nobody lives happily ever after, and we are right back to where we fucking started. And that's a problem I have too, boys. I am lockstep with both of you. Kylo negotiates with Von Cito for a bit and then kills him. So, welcome to the set, Max. We're going to kill you now. Meanwhile, Poe is captured and asks Kylo who's supposed to talk first. Kylo requests that he be brought on board. And then this is where we meet...
Gotta say, though.
Plasma? Phasma?
Captain Phasma. But before then, you have one of those,
okay,
ooh, looky the new stuff. And they got a big, oh, damn, in my audience was the force freezing of that laser bolt. Yeah. Every now and then they're peppering in stuff to be like, look at the power, look at the power, look at the power. And that got it. And even when I watch it this time, I'm like, okay, that's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, I mean, because like what Darth Vader does at an Empire, it just explodes. Like he deflects it.
Exactly.
And Han shoots at him. I love how he can stop it in midair.
I love this character of Phasma just because J.J. Abrams named her after Phantasm because he's a fan of that movie.
And she looks like the silver ball.
Yeah, exactly.
Enjoy it because it's Boba Fett for a whole new generation. She looks,
exactly.
She looks cool, but not much of a character. And I'll say, huge waste of Gwendolyn Christie, who was riding high off Game of Thrones.
Yeah, you could have done something with
certainly,
her.
Certainly, especially with what they established in this movie with her in charge of this whole, I guess, platoon of troopers, which are... This is one thing I do like. I like that the First Order went back to people versus clones. Because, for all intents and purposes, Kamino has long been destroyed. And unless you're a certain somebody, nobody knows how to clone. Not going to say who, but...
No, we'll get there. Meanwhile, a trooper doesn't have it in his heart to kill the villagers, and he makes a run for it as BB-8 rolls away.
Wow.
I like this idea of a trooper going rogue. I think it's a good idea, even though we have been told that, you know, later on we'll learn that Finn has been pretty much raised and groomed to be an Imperial trooper, right? And this first bit of killing, he just runs away. I have a bit of a problem with that.
I don't have a problem with it. I hate it. I hate it. You've been conditioned since birth. And I think we're going to start to have some problems here in this moment, because this is a great idea if it's followed through. Guess what, everybody? Spoiler alert, somehow shit's not followed through. So,
also, this would have worked if you had said he had abandoned his posts before, like he was going to be executed if he did it again. Like, if there was some form of context to this. Because the way it plays is that it's a one-off instance, and Faz was like, I'm going to have you brainwashed and demoted or whatever she says. Right away, what to Adam's point, stuff that's great in concept but is not followed up through appropriately.
Poe is brought onto what? Starkiller Base? That's what this is?
This is his ship. Which, it's a, I want to say they call it, no, it's not a dreadnought. I can't remember the name of it. But it, see, this is another problem. It's 30 years later. All you did is make another Star Destroyer. That's it.
Yeah.
It's a Star Destroyer. How do you not have some of the best concept artists in the fucking world make some new ship designs?
Well, that's the thing with everything with the First Order. It's the Empire with a fresh coat of paint and some primer. The Stormtroopers look exactly the same outside of some minor, I think there's some lines.
Change the helmet at...
Yeah, there's some helmets that, you know, they're stockier. The Star Destroyers look exactly the same. The officers all dress basically like the Imperial officers did. And spoiler alert, the biggest one of all, is a motherfucking Death Star!
When they get inside this ship, I love that hangar bay. Because we've never really seen that before. So seeing the TIE fighters on the wall getting ready to launch in their brackets and all that, I adore it now. I'm even more jaded and biased now. Because, and Matt can... go with me on this. When you ride Rise of the Resistance at Galaxy's Edge, you walk into this hangar bay. And it is life-sized. And it is a, oh my god, they rebuilt this moment. But I love finally being able to see, because I love, those that have heard me talk about it before, I love the starship side of this. So give me X-Wings and TIE Fighters and Interceptors and I'm a happy man. Though I wish they updated more than just even gave the TIE Fighters a fresh coat of red brick and paint on one side.
I mean, it's the same thing with the Resistance. They have X-Wings still.
But I love the look of this bay.
Finn takes his helmet off and it's revealed to be John Boyega. Alright, so as I mentioned before, he was definitely hired off of Attack the Block. I think Boyega does a good job in this. I wish the character went further than it does in this movie. We'll talk about future sequels later. Let's not talk about future sequels. Let's just talk about him in this movie. Adam, how do you feel about John Boyega in this movie?
I think he does some good stuff, and I think he does some horrible stuff. And some of that's later on in it. But I think he's a good choice to bring in. I've not seen Attack of the Block, but I heard it's fantastic. But I have seen the sequel to Pacific Rim, and I think that's Oh, my God.
Oh.
I think he does well. I like him and Ray, Daisy Ridley, I think they have really good chemistry.
Oh, yeah.
I think he and Poe want to bang the fuck out of each other for the first time they lock eyes. But I think he does well, but I think some of the choices they have to make later on, it feels like they just kept shooting when they were fucking around on set and they kept it in the film. He does fine to good, but I don't think it's a star-making performance.
I'm in agreement, and I'll go one step further. I think I would have had Finn be the one who supposedly perishes when they crash and have Poe be the one to go with Rey.
I
just think he's a more interesting character, and when Finn gets to the end of the movie and gets stabbed, you could have killed him off right there and his arc would have been over. Like, he would have served his purpose. But I think that's fine, but there's too many instances where I think he's mugging for the camera because he didn't realize they were shooting.
Yep.
So Finn gets chastised for disobeying orders as we cut to Rey. She drinks what water she has left and slides down past the Star Destroyer that she's on board and onto the grounds of Jakku. I do like the economic way all these characters are getting introduced here, and I'm liking being reintroduced to this world. Adam, are you liking the way JJ's outlining this Star Wars world? Do you feel like you're in a Star Wars film here?
I do. And this here with introducing to Rey with Daisy Ridley, other than when I look and I go, oh my god, it's fucking sand. And I literally can't believe it. I'm like, I can't believe they took us back to fucking Tatooine. We learn it's not, but that must just be semantics, because yes, it is. I absolutely love the way she's introduced, and seeing these fallen AT-AT, seeing the Star Destroyer here in the sand, I think that is just great. I think the looks of this are just superb.
Yeah, I do feel like JJ is making it feel like we never left this world. I like the feel of the movie so far.
To the point you just made about reimmersing yourself in the world, I think he does that with the iconography and the locations, but he doesn't do it in the story. And that's my problem with Abrams as a filmmaker. I think he is a very good director. When you look at how his movies look, how they move, I think he works well with actors, but I think he's a bad storyteller. And I do think there is a discernible difference. Like, right with this scene, I don't think this was the appropriate time to introduce Rey. Because logically, it should be after the crash, they land on the planet, and you cut to someone who's actually living here. I know that sounds trivial, but as far as Rey goes, I think Daisy Ridley has a ton of screen presence. I'm definitely intrigued when she makes her debut. And much like Boyega, I do think there are a couple moments where they don't 100% know what to do with her. But all in all, if there was one thing outside of the New Hope argument, the Mary Sue argument was a big... I definitely remember that.
Thank you, Max Landis. Yeah, I remember it too. We're learning that Rey is selling scraps to make ends meet. I like this image of her eating at the feet of this AT-AT. That's an awesome shot. She rescues BB-8 from who we learn is Tito, and then she asks BB-8 where he came from and gives him some advice as she points him towards the town. But he's insistent, and they head away. This BB-8, this was a big part of the marketing as well. I thought for sure this was a full CGI creation, but when I watched Star Wars Celebration and JJ went up on stage with the actual model itself, I was blown away by the fact that they were able to make this a practical effect, and it works. I think BB-8 has some great moments here. He's an adorable character.
I adore this droid, and I've not been one that's been kind to the droids in this series. I think the design of it is fantastic. I've watched a lot of making of, and yeah, they said that they were having a hard time. And then when they put that little, what looks like an eyebrow or an eyelid over its big eye there, everybody just went, and just that gasp in a room let them know that they brought emotion to it. That it's practical is amazing, because there's no reason to do practical. There isn't. It probably made it more difficult. I appreciate that. I'm grateful for it. When I've been to Lucasfilm offices up here in the Presidio in San Francisco, at one point they had one of the real BB-8 models out. It's just great. I absolutely love that droid. I really do.
Oh, you're going to make me be the bad guy, huh? No, I think BB-8 is more useful and enjoyable than R2-D2 and C-3PO combined. I have a real affinity for this character, and I can't explain why. I think part of it is because, like, to your point, the fact that they actually put the effort in to make this live action, because that messes up everything from your takes to your markers.
Oh, yeah.
It can be a nightmare when you're working with these kinds of things, especially on something of this scale, which I think was the most expensive movie at the time. I don't remember what you said for the budget, but it's...
$447.
God, that's insane. But, yeah, I think it's amazing what they can convey with nothing but beeping noises.
Kylo then rakes up Poe, who's not giving in, even while Kylo is making things very painful, but he does eventually give up that the map is in a droid. We see Rey pretty much rescue BB-8. Again, this movie is saving beasts from the first trilogy for when they think they're needed. And you know what? I am liking being in the beginning stages of this movie way more than I remembered. So this beat was really worked for me.
And I am as well, because as much as... You know, I'm like, this and that. And I got little grumps. But it's setting something up at this point. You know, it's the intro's over. We're 10 minutes in. We're starting to tell something with the story. We're getting further along. And, yeah, I'm enjoying this slow ride up the coaster.
You also, I think this was important because it would have been very easy to make your legacy characters the main stars of the movie. And I was impressed at just how long they waited to get your first major one. Because the hurdle is you have to ultimately sell this trilogy on your new characters. And I think the way this movie opens does that for your new main three, to varying degrees, because Poe does get sidelined for a considerable portion of the movie. But I like how they're setting it up. I mean, four, if you want to include Kylo Ren. I like the modulation on his voice because it's clearly him trying to make himself sound more badass than he actually is.
Yeah.
You know, you just look at him. You know, he's kind of this scrawny guy with the lightsaber that doesn't work. My theory is he just doesn't know how to make one.
Yeah, that's the theory. Yeah, that's a pretty logical theory.
Because that's why it's all, like, jagged.
Well, you talk about the new characters, and apparently the first script done by Michael Arndt had a lot of Luke in it. And I think JJ scrapped that because he thought the same way you did, Matt, that in order to get these characters to be cared about and be embraced by fans, we need to meet them early. And when we see a character, I'll go ahead and say, when we see Han actually embrace these characters, it makes us embrace these characters. I think they're doing a really good job of setting them up, because Star Wars is a weird franchise in that we have grown up with these characters for so long. Now we're going to have new characters. And Adam, you outlined it perfectly in the beginning of this podcast. Your daughter gravitated to Rey. We need to see how she gets to where she is and how Han and Leia actually embrace this character. And I think JJ's doing a good good job of that. And, of course, Kasdan and everybody else who had work done on the script.
I also think that if this movie centered around the OG3, you know, and then use those three to slip in new people, I think then when you took away those original trilogy members, I think you would have had a bigger revolt against, oh, now you just took them away, we're supposed to accept the fake new heroes. So I think it's integrated about as well as you can do.
And they're also clearly, you know, they're archetypes, much like Han, Luke, and Leia, but they're different enough. Like, there's no Jedi here. Rey's not a princess. Although, gonna be honest, the minute I saw her sit down in that fucking sandbox, I'm like, this is Tatooine. I swear to God, I'm gonna scream. And then they go, no, it's Jakku. And I'm like, that's actually even dumber, because there's two planets that look exactly like Tatooine.
You know why I like it, though? I like it because they do counteract it. Like, Luke, in the beginning stages of New Hope, was all about getting off that planet.
Yep.
I need to get off. I'm just going to go to get some power converters. I need to get off this planet. You know, he's a big whiny character in that. Here, Rey wants to stay here. When she gets the calling, when we talk later on, she still doesn't want to get the fuck off this planet. And I do like that bit of counteraction between the first trilogy and this. Yes, it is Tatooine renamed, but I don't have any real problems with it because of what it's doing to this character. Meanwhile, Poe saves Finn, and I will say, I love seeing Adam, you and I, when we grew up, we had these TIE Fighter toys. I'm loving that we're seeing what's inside the actual TIE Fighter and how it takes off. This is stuff we've never seen before. This is when the movie's at its best. When it's taken iconography we've seen before, and it's doing little different things with it, with a little twist.
Yeah, I really like seeing inside here. Even though, as much as I'm complaining about, you know, not seeing new designs, I love the TIE Fighter, I love the sound design from, you know, that Burt brought in those original films. So hearing the screech as that TIE Fighter finally breaks free and takes off, like, I'm just, oh. I do have a little bit of an issue of their conversation. Just feels like it just wasn't scripted well. You know, you get a little bit of it, but Finn not knowing how to shoot, but then he can shoot, and it's not great, but it's fine and does the job. I do think the bromance between these two works, but I think that Poe himself is just carrying the heavy load for these two like nothing else. Like, I just think he's acting circles around him. But I think part of that is just because of Finn is so underdeveloped. I think they had an idea that wasn't finished, where Poe is everything we've gotten out of these fighter pilots that we've known already.
His character's not finished. I see what you did there.
I thought the same thing.
But I'm sort of in agreement as well. I feel like these two are gay lovers, and the movie just doesn't want to admit it. But this movie also has, in certain spurts, the Marvel problem of, we're just going to let them banter and not give them any framework to work around. Kind of like that, or that Joss Whedon type of, we're going to be snarky just to be snarky. There's just a couple scenes where they do that. Who talks first, me or you, or the stuff in the TIE Fighter with the two of them. I think there's a couple times where they could have, you have Lawrence Kasdan, let him write the full script. Easiest paycheck of his life, too. I get paid to write the same script again, basically.
Well, remember what we talked about with the prequels? He was asked to come to do those, and he said, no, I don't want to do stuff that's already happened. I want to work on things that happen in the future, and that's exactly why Abrams brought him onto this project. And you know what, Adam, you and I talked about this a lot when this movie was out. This movie is not just done by two or three people. This movie is written by boatloads of people. I mean, there are so many producers, so many people that I guarantee that there are things here that even Kasdan didn't know hit the page.
Well, and on top of it, when you have something like this, you're giving your writer and you're saying, hey, this is your beat for here, 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 and here. Now connect it.
Yeah.
Because we've already started spending money on digital assets. We've already started doing storyboards. So find a way to connect these awesome images we got. Go. And I just think it shows. But to me, that's my big studio problem anymore. You got a date, you got a title. Go hit it.
Yeah, in fact, they were concerned about all of this. They wanted another year to work on the script to get it right, and Disney was not budging on that. So
I'm not saying bad. Yeah. It's just not as good as it could be, and sometimes just leaving out a line, saying nothing,
exactly.
Sometimes would make some of these scenes a lot better.
I think the big compromise is they removed all the backstory about the First Order and the context of this world. That was probably the stuff that they were really looking to flesh out, which is why it's basically not here at all.
And knowing Disney, you probably had, oh, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make 10 books about how this came to be and sell it that way.
We then meet Hux, and then that's the end of that. Not much to say about this character. Finn wakes up on Jakku and he sees the whole ship blow up. And I like exploring this world with these characters, you know. It's nice seeing this world through their eyes. Meanwhile, Kylo is trying to appear tough, saying that he wants that droid, no questions asked.
I think this is something that could have been very interesting, the Hux-Kylo Ren dynamic, where...
Yeah.
I like how in this, it's not a Tarkin-Vader thing, where Tarkin is clearly his superior. These two are basically on an even playing field. One's Snoke's left hand, one's the right hand. I like the idea of the... You know, the guy who's, you know, buttoned up, you know, I went to the academy, I know my military shit, and I'm stuck with this emotional baggage who just does dumb shit all the time, like losing his temper, but Snoke keeps him around because of the, you know, the force component. They could have done something interesting about having, like, a, you know, your two villains, one's the military tactician and the other's powerful force user, and I think these two could have had a really competitive rivalry throughout this entire, not just movie, but series.
Mm-hmm. I think the wannabe aspect of the Kylo character is something that they really could have played with. And that was something I used to bump up against when I first watched this movie. I thought, this is an unimposing character. He's throwing fits in these control rooms. He is not scary whatsoever. He is a Darth Vader fanboy. We're going to see the helmet later on in this movie. He wants to be Darth Vader. He's trying to modulate his voice to be Darth Vader, but he's not Darth Vader. And I think his drive to be that, despite being the son of the two most iconic characters of this series, arguably, is something they really could have played with that they don't. And I'm not talking about future sequels. I'm talking about this movie. When we see what he does to his father later on in this movie, this is something that could have been played with there that they didn't. And I think there was something lost there, especially when you have someone like Adam Driver in this role.
Yeah, well, it's there at surface level, but the problem is Kylo Ren gets kind of sidelined because so much of this movie is a fetch quest.
Yeah.
That you really don't get to dive into him as a villain. And you have a lot more real estate to do that with this movie, especially with who he is. And I mean, there's character development in this movie, but it's really minimal when you look at the three hero characters. Because, like, this movie has to juggle a lot of balls. And remember, they left the biggest one, Luke. It's not he's not allowed to go into the sandbox until the last 30 seconds. So, you know, you're not having to wrestle with that. But I think the whole fanboy component of wanting to be something you're not, he's that rebellious, bratty teenager. It's there, but it really should have been much more at the forefront.
And I think they abandoned it because, and I'm going to bring up that mask now then, because you see that Vader mask on a little pedestal only when Kylo is talking to it. There's a scene in this movie where it's the same room, Rey's in there, and he puts his helmet on that pet. There's no Vader helmet there. That Vader helmet is only there when he's talking to it. And I always thought that was his manifestation, and that was like his dark side psychosis or something trying to bring Vader out of him. And that would be just amazing to delve into. But I don't think any writer in this has the ability or just want on Disney's level to bring that out.
I thought that's what he was trying to do, like an ancient ritual. Sort of like,
yeah.
Oh, you know, in the Obi-Wan show, he keeps trying to talk to Qui-Gon. Or I thought he was trying to, like, physically put himself in the plane to talk to Darth Vader, and that's why he kept the helmet, which, to Adam's point, I like that he's the only one who basically knows that it's his contraband item that he snuck in.
Finn meets Rey, and Adam, I believe you mentioned this earlier, the chemistry between these two is just fantastic.
It's a nice little meet-cute. Like, if they get a lot, and I think maybe it's, hey, look, they're both fairly new. They're both British, though they're about the only ones not doing British accents in this film.
Yeah,
but I think they work very well alongside each other. And I'm glad they don't go the obvious route. I'm so glad they don't go the obvious route.
Well, I feel like they insinuate it.
Yeah.
But talk about that later. I will say, I think this reinforces these two are gay lovers argument, because he takes the jacket. It's like when Heath Ledger touches Jake Gyllenhaal's shirt at the end of Brokeback Mountain.
He's wearing Poe's Letterman jacket. There's no doubt. Give him the class ring.
Finn and Rey, they talk about their respective missions, and when Finn mentions Skywalker, Rey responds, I thought he was great.
This is when I feel bad, because you know that she probably had to do like 30 takes, and JJ was like, oh, fuck, you know what? We can't be that. We can't do like 4 days of her trying to do one line. Just put in one of those. She's hamming it up so much, and it's, you know, I don't blame her, but I don't think JJ's got it in him to direct younger actors that are so new.
Respectfully disagree, because he did it in Super 8.
I was just about ready to say that, yeah.
Yeah,
he does it pretty well in that.
Yeah, because that movie is really his, if this is plagiarism, then
I don't know what Super 8 would be. That would be, like, outright thievery to the point of going to court because it's such a Spielberg wannabe.
Well, Spielberg was a producer on that, and it goes to what we were saying in that J.J. is really good at recreating these worlds. You felt like you were in an Amblin production in that movie, and that's exactly what he was looking at doing, until we get to the alien stuff in that, which maybe we'll cover that one day. But
yeah, and I picture Spielberg sitting in the, looking at the dailies like Palpatine going, good.
This was a part I did not like, was when Rey is yelling at Finn to stop taking her hand as they run to a ship that explodes. This felt like female empowerism, where we're just like, I don't need a man to help me get to where I need to go.
I didn't feel that in this movie, but I'll pigeonhole that for later.
Yeah, put it in.
She kind of reminds me of when you watch Chris Hemsworth in the first Thor movie, where it's like, yeah, he's got the right energy, and he's fun to watch, he's charismatic, but do a few more takes on his lines at certain points.
As they keep running, Rey tells Finn that the ship he's looking at is a piece of junk. And then the camera pans, and wouldn't you know it, there's the Millennium Falcon, and it got another bit of applause in the audience I was with. It was pretty fantastic.
I can't believe we're at the point where people are cheering over a goddamn ship.
I tell you, man, when this ship has been around as long as it has, it was a really cool film. Especially since, you know, Williams, this is a really good musical sting by him. Again, when he's using old themes, it works really well. We have the old Falcon theme, I guess you can say, when they pan over to it, and it's a pretty good moment. Adam, you gotta go agree with this, right?
I cheered, and my audience cheered. I can believe it, because I'm the sappy son of a bitch that, even though he paid $200 to walk into Hollywood Studios in Florida, when I turn the corner and I'm face to face with a life-size Millennium Falcon, I just still caught my breath. So that's me. This is for me. This is for the old folks.
Yeah, pretty much.
I guess I'd shut up, because if that was the Hogwarts castle, I would have done the same thing.
Yeah.
All right, I'll shut up.
Meanwhile, BB-8 just keeps rolling along. And you know what I like about this, too? I like how Rey doesn't automatically know how to drive this ship, and Finn has no idea of how to use the gunners on it. They are learning on this
like
thing.
Kids. They're like kids when you give them a like a rotary phone.
Yeah.
This is the one thing in the movie, though, that she does not know how to do at first.
Good point. Yeah.
Which is weird, because everything else she can do basically no problem, which I think the Mary Sue argument is an oversimplification. But it does bother me that she doesn't know how to do this, which is the first thing, and ostensibly looks like the most difficult, piloting a ship, especially one that requires at least two people, because you never saw Han fly it solo in the original movies. Han flying it solo. Bad humor. But everything else she could do with seemingly no effort or training.
And honestly, that was my big beef with this character. Was a massive thing with me. I'm not going to oversimplify it as well, but she is too good. And I'll get to the Force scenes when we get to them later, but she is too perfect a character, and that does bug me.
I really like the scene with the ship here. And we're going to get into it. I'll discuss my Rey thoughts, you know, as we get into it. But this scene right here, and I actually have a giant, like, 24x36 mounted image of the Falcon going through the desert from this. This is such a fun scene. Now, I got little issues with the sizing of how they do it. Like, the proportions of shit doesn't always work out, you know, the way they're doing this film. And as somebody who's got giant hardback books on the sizes of capital ships in Star Wars, I'm that nerd. I know the difference in size between a Star Destroyer and a Super Star Destroyer. But that they did, you know, once they finally fly into it, it's accurate. And I'm just like, oh my god, that is great. That is so much fun.
It's a bit rocky getting this ship up as BB-8 tumbles and TIE fighters attack. The Finn finally figures out the gunners and takes the fighters out. The Falcon moves into a Star Destroyer as Finn takes out the last TIE fighter. How do we feel about the way the Falcon's just taking out these TIE fighters? I think this is a pretty fun scene.
I agree as well.
I think it's fun. I think Finn's a little too comfortable on the controls, but this is like the second time that he's in the bitch seat of a starship really quick.
Yeah.
And again, it's seeing the same identifiers is, we're going back to some of those member berries a little too often already, but man, this is fun.
Rey tells BB-8 they will get him home as the two introduce themselves to each other. We then cut to Kylo Ren just having a complete hissy fit about his men losing BB-8.
God.
I thought this was, you know, he's that angsty teenager.
Yeah.
You know, and he's not in control of his emotions, which I like how that sort of ties into Anakin as well.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
That's part of his bloodline. But I love
the two stormtroopers that just say, fuck this, and leave.
Yeah.
Do the 180.
And this is also the first time we see Ren's red lightsaber in action, is when he's cutting this control room up. Let's get to this thing. It was another big thing of contention with fans. As soon as they saw that trailer and they saw Ren light that lightsaber, it's like, oh, God, handlebars on it? Really? How do we feel about the way Ren's lightsaber is here? I like it just because we mentioned the sparks and things that are coming from it, because he doesn't know what he's doing. And I like that about it. He added these things here, probably because he thought it looked cool, but it doesn't. It's not going to do anything to help you. If anything, it's going to cut your fucking hand off if you get hit in the correct way.
I think it looks awesome. I mean, the first time that you see it in the trailer, you're like, oh, shit! You know, that's different. It looks like a crossguard on a sword, so really cool design to bring it in. I know from nerd knowledge that it's to vent because it's uncontrolled focus that he's put into his kyber crystal, but by the end of the series, I got a problem because he was trained by the best there is, and he knows how to build a lightsaber. So much like the saber, it's unfocused. But I do think it goes to Kylo. I think it goes to his insecurities and his rage. So the saber's cool. Him being a little whiny bitch destroying stuff, I could do without every fucking time because it's laughable to me.
Oh, interesting. I think Matt hit it for me, too, is that Darth Vader was in control of his emotions. Kylo Ren isn't. And that's again the contrast of Darth Vader versus Kylo Ren and who Kylo Ren thinks he is as opposed to who he really is. So
I agree.
I
think if he would have brought somebody to him and ran him through or cut him in half, yes. Him punching the walls of his room like a 14-year-old is where I'm just like, ugh, really?
Don't forget this is Disney. They're not going to cut somebody out. Jesus.
No, not even going to kill anybody with that lightsaber. Right.
They cut Thanos' head off.
Matt, how are you feeling about Ren's lightsaber here?
I think it looks cool. You know, it's a different design. And unlike Darth Maul, the lightsaber doesn't define the character, where it's not the only thing you remember about them. Although I do like how it sort of matches his mood because it's not in control like he is out of control. But I like that. That's a line of poetry right there for, you know, Lucas.
Rey starts working on the Falcon as Finn tells BB-8 that he's not really a part of the Resistance. Power within the ship is lost as they're caught in a tractor beam. They go to the compartments from A New Hope as Han and Chewie emerge and say, they're home. Here's our reemergence of Han and Chewbacca. Great seeing these two back on screen. I enjoy seeing Chewbacca alongside Han, which is what it should be. And I think Harrison Ford is happy to be here. I think this is the first time in a long time that we are seeing him engaged, especially with this character that he supposedly didn't want anything to do with back in 1983. I think he's having fun here, and I think his performance here is one of the best performances I've seen in probably about 15 years when this movie came out.
So, let me say it's been a long time since I've watched this movie. I think the last time was right before Last Jedi and all that, so it's been over 5 years. I remember him being a lot flatter than he actually is in this movie. On first watch, I felt like he was just kind of going through the motions, sort of Alec Guinness-ing it in a certain way, like especially with Return of the Jedi. But he's a lot better here than I remember him being. He actually does feel like Han Solo, in a way where I didn't just see Harrison Ford, although someone should have told him to get a haircut and shave a bit, because he just looks all disheveled and shit. But how is it he looks scruffier than Chewbacca? Because you look at Chewbacca, he's got this perfect perm, and he doesn't look like he does an Empire where his fur's all matted. Chewbacca's aged a lot, I guess Wookiee's aged considerably better than humans do in this universe, but I think he's good, but I don't like that Han Solo just went back to doing what he did previously.
Well, I do, and I tell you why. I'll go ahead and get into this right now before I go to Adam about Harrison Ford. I like it because he is back doing this because of what Kylo Ren is doing and how that broke him and Princess Leia up. General Leia, I guess, at this point. I think this is a result of what happened with Kylo Ren, and now he's back to smuggling. Now, we'll get to what he's smuggling here in a bit, and I do have a bit of a problem with that, but the fact that he's back to being a smuggler and out in space doing what he was doing before, I have no issues with. I did it first, but when I thought about it, it's like, you know what? This kind of shit This is what happens with couples where tragedy hit. This is what happens when their kids die or their kids go off and do what Kylo Ren is doing here. So I really don't have any issues with what he's doing here. Plus, it has to be said too, he doesn't want any part of Leia. So he's doing this to stay away from her. So all of this, I mean, you could have rewritten it. You could have had it so that he's doing something else. But this, I have zero issues with. Adam, how do you feel about Harrison Ford? And how do you feel about where he is? Break the tie.
I'm so glad to see him back. I feel like he's putting in a better performance here than he had in a very, very long time, or since, really. Initially, I was like, oh, man, Calista had to talk him into going back to work. But I'm glad to see he actually brings Harrison Ford back to Han Solo. I think he does a good job for the overwhelming majority. I like that he goes back to smuggling for a couple reasons. One, we never really saw it before, so to see it, and we'll get to the what we see here in a moment, but I like that he does it. And to your point, Garrett, we feel like the parents have gone through tragedy, and so often that breaks up a marriage, breaks up a relationship. I feel like that's on point. What I could have used, and it would have helped our discussion that we've had about First Order, is him saying something to the point of, look, when I can't help stop the rise of evil, I have to go back to doing what I know. You know, just something that he was a part of this politic world that left him behind because they weren't going to stop evil anymore. And he decided to go back to knowing what he knows. But I'm glad to see him back. This was another cheer moment. And Han Solo is one of my heroes, and I think he brings him back well. Though the second he's on screen, there's buzzards flying around.
Oh, God. Yeah, they're already. I completely agree with you. The scythe is coming down as soon as he hits the screen.
I knew as soon as he agreed to be in this movie, I'm like, yeah, the parameters included. I have to emphatically die.
And it's a fairly well-known story, but I'll go ahead and say it anyway, that he was happy to be here, but within 2 weeks, he had broken his ankle. So he was offset for a bit. And apparently, when that blast door came down on him, JJ went to go help him. And JJ threw out his back while trying to pull that door up. So he was working with a hurt back without telling anybody for a couple of weeks. And so Harrison Ford, you know, he's trying to do what he was doing before, and his body's not really agreeing with him. I am liking this conversation between Han and these two as well, because, again, I'll say it again, Han accepting these two makes me accept them. I think the interaction that he's having here is fun stuff.
I think him looking to them to the future lets us look to them to the future, and God knows the other older characters in this film, they don't give that kind of time to let them do it. So, I think it's important that, of anybody, our hero sells these kids to us.
Rey mentions that she's heard of the 12 parcel run. They mention Luke as Han goes, yep, I knew him. And Williams is really painting pictures with his themes here. Again, when he goes back to these old themes, the score works. Every time Han mentions Luke's name, we're hearing the Luke theme. Stuff like that does work for me.
And I like how there's a little bit of, and this is a credit to Harrison Ford, you can tell there's some kind of resentment between him and Luke, based on how he's directing this conversation. So clearly, with what happened, Luke had some involvement. And circumstances being what they were, I do think the big tragedy of this trilogy is the three of them do not have a scene together. Obviously, with Carrie Fisher's passing, that made it unavoidable, but it's...
Yeah, it was planned.
It's also a bad gamble. Of the three, Leia's the one that lived, and sadly the actress is the one that we lost.
Matt brings up a point that I can't believe I'd never thought of before, that Luke's role in what happens with Kylo that never crossed my mind before, and I can't believe it didn't, but that's huge.
We hear that a Rathtar has made its way on board. Han tells Rey and Finn to stay in the compartment as Han tries talking his way out of trouble, and I do like that we're seeing the inside of these compartments. These are things I dreamt about seeing when I was a kid. You know, obviously, you go to Disney World and you can see it in person, but as a kid, I never saw it on film, and it was cool to see them actually hide here and see the inside of it.
Seeing the hidden compartments inside of the ship, like, that's something I've read about over and over and over, so yeah, that's kind of cool. But these Rathdars.
All right, let's get to them. So, Rey opens the blast door and lets the Rathtar in, and man, do I not like the look of this creature. It seems like he took a discard from Cloverfield and brought it onto this set and said, yeah, we're going to do something with this. Oh, God, I hate these fucking things.
Somebody at Disney has a hentai fetish, because...
Yeah. Damn it, Matthew.
There are so many of these freaking H.P. Lovecraft Cthulhu-looking things in this, Guardians 2. So many of their properties have this hentai shit, and it's that weird groupthink that just tends to happen at Disney with them having so many properties. Sorry for stealing your thunder, but that's where my brain went, because I would have cut this whole sequence.
Yeah, me too.
Everything that happens here once they get into this weird freighter between who I keep calling freaking Culture Club, Kanji Club, I can't even remember Culture Club, and this other group, it doesn't matter other than to set up that, okay, Han Solo pissed off bad people. Like, you could have cut or trimmed this entire thing down and saved yourself 15 minutes, probably saved yourself $30 million, and the film would have been better for it. It just doesn't do much.
Rey and Finn are chased as Rey closes the blast door on the Rathar. We say that 12 times fast. Chewie gets shot as Han takes his bowcaster. Han then takes control of the Falcon as they're able to take off and immediately jump into hyperspace. This I had a little bit of a problem with. We always have to gather, okay, what's going, are the stars clear? I know we haven't seen that for a few films, but still, like, the fact that they could just take off and then immediately go into hyperspace, that kind
of
bugged me.
This is one of those, hey, I've got an idea of something that I would have done with my toys as a kid, you know, that he's doing.
Yeah.
And the whole, you know, when C-3PO is giving him odds and he never tell me the odds, like, that's a good character moment. To try to replay it here in a way that just doesn't sell it as well is disappointing.
I did like that we're seeing the hyperdrive from the windows again, though. That a really nice callback.
Yeah, but you know what? You can stand directly behind a ship that's taken off in hyperspace, and all it does is knock you over.
True. All right, we talked about the Rathars. We had to get to this character eventually. Hux goes over strategy with Snoke. Snoke. Seems like we're covering all of Andy Serkis's resume this year. But here he is, playing this character that, okay, we'll talk about next week what happens to him, but let's talk about him in this film. He's a hologram here. We supposedly think that he's mighty tall, he's mighty big, he's mighty imposing. How do we feel about Snoke's use in this film?
You can add Andy Serkis to the Max Van Sydow and Gwendolyn Christie grouping of wasted actors. You could have had anybody play this role, and I feel bad for Andy Serkis. He gets to be in Star Wars finally, and you really give him nothing to do besides monologue and be a patsy because they didn't want to use the Emperor, so they came up with another Emperor.
I hate that.
Just think everything with this character is so muddled, and yeah. I think if you were going to do this, this also required an explanation. How is there another powerful Force user that is seemingly running the First Order and nobody puts the connection together that, hey, maybe this could be the Emperor because this shit wasn't planned out?
It's so disappointing that this is what they did here. I hate this character. I'm not even talking about what happens to him in the future. I'm talking about what happens with him here. It's a terrible introduction. I hate the design of it, too. Like, all of it just does not work for me.
I like him in this film. I think it's a show that there's a bigger bad. There's no surprise. That's Vader Emperor shit. But at least we get it here. We didn't get the Emperor until Empire Strikes Back last time. I'm glad they don't wait to show us that he's just a hologram and he's not that big. You know, they kind of let us know right away. I hate Hux and Kylo being there together, though. I can't stand Hux and Kylo together. I know you like, I can't stand it. Donald Gleason, get him out of this film as soon as you can. It just annoys me to no end. But the issue is, Matt said it, Garrett said it, what do you do with that character? Well, guess what? If you're going to introduce him, maybe you have an idea what to do. They don't. So in retrospect, when I'm watching it for this, I don't like it. But when it's just here for the first time and you see this guy and you know that he's the reason that's pulled Kylo Ren and, ooh, I can't wait to find out later what he did to pull Kylo Ren and who this big bad guy is. It's interesting here. The disappointment for me comes later.
Well, even here, I just don't like that, again, it's the same fucking dynamic from the previous trilogy. You have the omnipotent embodiment of evil who uses the Force. You have the Force user, apprentice, that he has manipulated to some degree. And you have the military leader. The one thing I like is that he's purposefully playing Hux and Ren against each other, almost like he's like, all right, I will fully train whichever one of you kills the other.
I like that as well.
That's the one thing I like. It's not the rule of one bullshit or whatever it is, where he's got two equal confidants that he's kind of pitting against each other.
As Snoke tells Ren that there has been an awakening at the hands of Ren's father, Snoke dissolves.
You know what? The fact that they actually spoil that Han Solo is his father here, I don't understand why.
This I'm fine with. This I champion because I like that it's not played as a twist.
I like that it's not played as a twist, but it doesn't do much for me to reveal it here.
Because everybody and their mother knew.
Yeah.
I'm glad this was not saved for them going on that bridge, because that's so atypical of J.J. Abrams and his method of storytelling. I'm glad that it's dropped here, it's already established, it's already known, and we don't have to drag this out.
To me, the problem is every other thing that it implies that seemed like what they were going to do, because for those that don't know, Han and Leia have twins. One goes light, one goes... like, everything that they were going to follow. They go down the road just to get you going to a certain point and then veer off just because. To me, there's no doubt at this point, once they drop that Han Solo is Kylo's father, there's no doubt that Rey's his sister. No doubt.
Well, that's a whole conversation we'll get into.
Mm-hmm.
As far as it is here, I like that it's not in the mystery box and we're going to save it for the last minute, because it's actually treating the audience as somewhat smart. That was the most popular theory. They didn't try to pull the rug out for once. You know, this was not the, oh, Benedict Cumberbatch is not playing Khan, I promise.
Maybe I just don't like how it's done. The fact that you're going to say, your father, and then,
oh,
you know, Han Solo. Yes, I know my father's name, dipshit.
I can start my tangent now then of how this movie is the worst effect of playing the pronoun game.
Oh, shit. Here we go.
Between your father and our son, I'm like, that's not how these people would be fucking talking.
Finn tries bandaging Chewie up as Rey bypasses the compressor and fixes the Falcon, because of course she can.
As Han wouldn't know what to do since she breaks a piece off.
And she's a scavenger, so it makes sense that she would have some... I don't think this is anywhere near as ridiculous as her knowing how to fly the ship. Or not knowing how to fly the ship.
Okay.
And last, like, she is so happy to be sharing the screen with Harrison Ford. That smile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ear to ear.
It's like Karen Allen on...
Is it too late to make her Helena in Dial of Destiny? Maybe I could actually tolerate her if it was her secretly.
Oh, boy.
Wait for Solo.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, God.
We see the chessboard in action as Rey says that she's a scavenger and Finn's with the Resistance. They open the map and Han says that it's incomplete. He goes on to say that Luke left as he was training a new band of Jedis in an attempt to rebuild the Jedi Order. One turned against him, which caused him to go into hiding.
I wonder who that could be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is where I do think it's a bit, while I like that they reveal Kylo Ren as Han Solo's son, I don't like that they're also dancing around it here. It's like, you can't have it both ways. You can have some people act like it's, you know, a mystery, and then outright tell the audience.
Well, everybody would say it in a different way, though. You can't have them all talking about it. Han would treat this news differently than, say, Snoke would.
Yes, but it's fine here. The problem is when he starts talking to Leia.
Okay. Han then said that he thought the Jedi Temple was a bunch of mumbo-jumbo, but he knows from experience that all they have heard about the magic behind the Jedis is true, from a certain point of view. I added that last part. This was in the trailer, and I remember there was a little bit of a discourse behind that, because Han was the one who was always treating the Force as if it was mumbo-jumbo, but now he's come to embrace it. I don't know, I guess in 30 years he would.
Yeah, I mean, he saw two Death Stars destroyed, and if you have a child that's growing up and is strong in the Force, not to mention your wife, yeah, I have no problem with him coming to terms with admitting things that he once, you know, cast off as mumbo-jumbo. And I think him accepting what's going on lets us accept it.
I read this as basically when you have in the X-Men universe a human who marries a mutant and they have mutant offspring, they just accept it. And also, let's remember, Han Solo had a Force user take his gun out of his hand without physically touching it.
They didn't land on planet Takadana. And I love how Finn tells Han that he's a big deal in Resistance, and from this point on, his nickname is Big Deal. And then Han says, eventually, women always find out the truth, which I thought was pretty cool.
God, that's the truth.
Yeah, no shit. And I like the chemistry between these two, too. You know, I like Han talking to him and almost being like a mentor to him.
It's fun to play between them back and forth, you know, but it's also, I'm a big deal. Oh, big deal.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's kind of like what you get. Hey, I'm the new actor in Star Wars. I'm a big deal. Oh, really big deal.
Yeah, that's...
You know, it's just, there's some good fun to be mm-hmm. had here. It's,
for sure.
Yeah.
It's a little
meta. I like it, but they're... Yeah. It is, but they seem to be playing and having fun. Mm-hmm. I could use a little more of this, because the scenes that are forced feel forced. This is good stuff. And seeing this planet, I love the look of this planet. Oh my God, we actually have multiple topography on a frickin' planet. This is so nice to see.
Han tells Rey that he's thinking of offering her a job, but she says that she needs to head back home to Jakku. Han says that's too bad, because Chewie kind of likes her. They then make their way to Maz Kanata. Now, of course, JJ's panning the camera, and this is kind of made to resemble the cantina, you know, this whole scene here as we're getting introduced to Maz. This is played by Lupita Nyong'o, who is a tremendous presence. I like this character, even though she kind of looks like an old orange. But I like this character. I think she's really fun.
Again, I like the actress you cast, but sort of the Andy Serkis thing where I'm like, okay, you're just using motion capture because you have access to it. I don't feel like there's anything, like, this character could have been practical. And I feel the same way about Snoke, to be perfectly honest, but because you've got Andy Serkis, you felt the need to use the motion capture technology. What I don't like about this character is she's running a cantina. She's basically like a pirate for all intents and purposes. There's something, though, that I have a major question about, but I can't say yet.
Okay.
I dig it. I like the temple, walking in, seeing all the flags and everything else. It's a real Easter egg type moment. The pan through the bar. Is it the cantina scene? It is, but I don't think it's trying to hide that. I don't fault it, because it knows what it's doing. And I like Maz Kanata quite a bit. Lupita Nyong'o, I think, is an amazing actress. She's given shit to do in Black Panther, but I would love for her to be Storm in the X-Men movies if you let me cast that. I think she's great. I like what she brings to Maz. I think it's a fun character. Everything's... Where's my Wookiee?
Yeah, I love that she calls Chewie her boyfriend.
There's just some fun there. And I think we need a little bit of lighthearted alienness in this. So I like what she brings here. I like what they do with her here.
And, you know, we're getting a little bit of parallelism between this and New Hope here as well, because a spy catches them, because of course it does.
Multiple spies. You got one on each side, literally giving the same information.
Yeah, exactly. And then we're seeing Kylo Ren. He's talking to Vader's helmet and tells him that he's going to finish what Vader started. And I love, Adam, what you brought up earlier. This could not even be real. This could be him actually talking to nothing or talking to his own helmet. Mm-hmm. Great, great theory there. Meanwhile, Maz tells Han that she's not going to get the droid to Leia. He needs to do that himself. Finn says that there's no way they can win a fight against the First Order.
Marriage therapist Maz Kanata.
Yeah, exactly. Finn then leaves the group as he tells Rey that he's not a part of the Resistance. He's actually... What do you say? He's a janitor, pretty much? Rey hears cries for help as she makes her way down some steps. This scene is obviously supposed to resemble the tree from The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, it's supposed to?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
On that one, we had development before we got there.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I mean, I guess we're hearing the voices. We hear Alec Guinness, who, he says Ray, but I guess they had him saying afraid, and they took that and made Ray out of it?
They edited down his old work.
We're hearing Ewan McGregor here as well. We're hearing, I think, some Liam Neeson voices as well.
Qui-Gon's in there. Yeah. Obi-Wan is in there. I want to say there's another one or two in there as well. Yoda's in there. Yeah. So to me, this is a very, very sloppy way to be like, guess what? She has access to the Force.
Yeah.
And I think that was a surprise.
You know what makes it sloppy? What makes it really sloppy for me? This lightsaber was in a gas planet. It was thrown off in a gas planet. How the fuck did it end up in this fucking chest?
This is the thing that pissed me off.
Oh, I hate this.
Because when you think about the plausibility, the fucking lightsaber fell. Not just out of the building, off the goddamn planet, because Luke is dangling for dear life, and it drops, and somehow she gets it, because we're never going to find out the answer, and this is one of the biggest, the MacGuffin of the movie. This lightsaber is basically the MacGuffin of the movie, along with the map. We don't get a logical explanation for how it's back into play.
What she says is, it's a story for another time. Meaning, like, they're going to set, like, a story up for this. I guarantee that's what they were fucking doing.
But you have to, I think you have to.
Exactly, you do.
It's such an impactful moment when Luke gets his arm cut off, because he replaces his arm and his lightsaber in the same moment, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the same time frame. That's kind of undone by having someone just very easily pick it up off the ground and be like, I found something!
Exactly.
I don't mind that it's here. I mind that we don't know how, why, and everything else. That just bugs the shit out of me. It being found after Cloud City doesn't bug me, but that's because I read books where somebody also gets his hand and builds clones out of his hand that also gets cut off. Yes, they cloned Luke, L-U-U-K-E.
Oh, that's right. I remember stories.
So to me, that's... I don't care that it's found. I do care that, to me, this lightsaber is the embodiment of... Like, Kylo should be wanting this to go with that helmet. Because this is the lightsaber that slaughtered the younglings. This is the lightsaber that was there when he got killed on when Anakin died on Mustafar and became Darth Vader. So there is a story to be had here. And the slap in the face is that we don't get that story.
I kind of thought when the trailers are coming out, and there's no mention of a map, I thought the lightsaber was going to be what Kylo Ren was after. There's a shot in the trailer, it looks like Maz is handing Leia the lightsaber, not Rey. So I thought that somehow Leia got the lightsaber. That would have made more sense than Maz Kanata. At least Leia, you could say, the Force called me to it or something. Mm-hmm. This is
a familial connection.
And Kylo Ren wanting that, possibly Leia wanting it, because maybe it's got a tracker to find Luke, who knows. Because, as we find out, Luke has not touched this lightsaber since he got his arm cut off. He has not possessed it. You know, he replaced it for a better-looking one, for the record.
Rey having this just makes no sense.
No, Maz having it.
Rey eventually getting it makes no sense. Maz actually having it makes zero sense.
And I also think there were too much read into when Rey leaves the room and Maz says to Han, "Who's the girl?" I don't think that was meant to be, who are her parents? Yeah. It's just Maz, hey, who is that?
Yeah.
Like, people read way too much into that because the whole thing is like, Rey has to be related to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
If that lightsaber is calling to her, she has to be.
Yes.
Because it's not calling to just anybody. And to me, it can only call towards a Skywalker, not to spoil something later. Fuck that, no she's not. But it's a Skywalker saber.
I just wish the lightsaber wasn't here at all.
Me too. Maz tells Rey that the lightsaber has called to her, as she already knows the truth that nobody is coming back for her on Jakku, and that the Force surrounds her. She just says that she doesn't want any part of this, and that she's never touching that saber again. Little do you know, honey.
Yeah, because doesn't she see, like, she hits it, and there's, like, shit on fire? Like, the burnt-out temple,
Yeah, we're seeing things on the future fight, too.
Yeah, and I guess that's got to be Luke touching R2.
Yeah, that's Luke, yep.
Yeah, to me that's when Kylo and the Knights of Ren destroyed the Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, the Knights of Ren are such important characters too. Remember how hyped up you were in the market?
I bought their toys.
That's your problem.
Yes.
Hux says that today marks the end of the Republic, and that they will bow to the Republic as Starkiller fires its first shot at, what, Coruscant?
No, they explicitly come out and was like, it's not Coruscant. But it sure as hell looks like it. Okay, the first one. How much of an impact does destroying Alderaan have? That is an epic moment that is just mind-blowing. This thing, one, you know, I don't need the Nazi fucking image. You might as well just have him, well, they do the stomp and raise hand. Just might as well do this speech in German. Come on, man. Like,
well, if there's less,
we're going to go that on the nose. But to destroy, what, 5 or 7 planets in this star system? And to have no emotional connection, like, I don't care, it, to me, is such a mistake and such a misfire on this entire film's part, that you destroy a system and billions more people than you would have by destroying Alderaan, and I don't care, and the rest of this movie doesn't care, like, it skips by it.
Well, the impact is gone because we've seen this twice before. Not just A New Hope. They rebuild the Death Star in Return of the Jedi, and while it's not blowing up a planet, they find out it's operational by destroying one of the Rebel, like, fleet-leading ships. Death Stars are, to this franchise, what Sky Portals are to Marvel movies, where they just can't fucking get away from it, and this is the biggest, the worst example of just copying A New Hope. A
couple things here. One, they try getting around it by saying this is a fucking planet, which makes no sense. And two, you know how you make an emotional connection? You blow up Jakku. How easy would that have been? Instead, like Adam says, we have no emotional connection whatsoever. We see 6 different fucking sets of lasers come out of it and take these planets out, and that's it. Oh, it bugs me so much.
That would have been great that she can longer go home to where she's wanted to go to.
Yes.
Damn. It's like you have nowhere to go back to. Or you blow up Tatooine so we never have to see it again.
And I'm going to go ahead, I want to lay my cards on the table right now. As I restarted this movie, I was taken by how much I love being in this world. And the negative feelings I had leaving the initial screening I had were leaving me pretty quickly because JJ was bringing me back in. And the fact that I had no expectations really let me feel like I was in this world. But I got to tell you guys, from the moment Rey goes into that dark room till the end of this movie turns into kind of a jumbled mess.
Well, a mess, I think, is not the right word because it's easy to track what's happening. My problem is the redux is far more prominent in the second half of this movie as far as the plot goes than the first half. because it's ultimately about destroying the giant round thing. When you have fighters, and just with the inclusion of the lightsaber, you're calling back way too much to what's come before. And the first half, while it's got familiar beats, it's carving its own path to a certain degree. But from here on out, it's all about the iconography of stuff we've seen before, right down to the plot in and of itself. So that's my problem. I do agree. The inclusion of the lightsaber is the demarcation where I start to... I don't hate the rest of this movie, but I think the first half is a hell of a lot stronger than the second half.
So you're saying this is Rob Zombie's Halloween? The Redux comes at the end of the second half?
Actually, yeah, that's a good idea, because I like the Halloween a lot. And then the second half, I think it's fucking dark.
Exactly.
It's not as bad as that. So, like, this is not as bad.
Yeah. Adam, how do you feel? Do you feel the same way that after this it kind of goes downhill?
So I see a lot of the same beats, but I see enough differences, and I see some really cool stuff that I'm enjoying. Are there some same beats? Yes. But I think there's enough changes and I enjoy it. And I do want to say, this thing is shot really, really well. So I do think it looks good. And some of the times where I'm rolling my eyes at what's going on, I like what I'm looking at.
We cut to Rey running through the forest as BB-8 catches up to her. She says that she's leaving and that he needs to go back. He's too important. We then see Rey having problems with the blaster safety. I didn't know these blasters had safeties.
Maybe that explains why the stormtroopers couldn't hit shit.
Yeah! As Ren and his men invade. Han is firing on all cylinders, by the way, and Maz gives Finn the lightsaber. Wait, what? Finn has the lightsaber now?
I'm going to give a hot take here. I am perfectly okay with non-Jedi being able to use a lightsaber.
Well, I think this works because of the way Finn has no idea what he's fucking doing with it. It's like Han waving it in Empire Strikes Back. We saw it before, but this guy has no fucking clue.
He's clumsy with it, and even though he has one, he's even outmatched by a stormtrooper.
Yeah.
Let alone when he turns. Fight Kylo Ren later on, so I'm perfectly okay with this, but Maz should be like, okay, this guy clearly would have no use for it. Just give him a gun.
Exactly. Yeah, he was a trooper.
You know who finally got this right was the third season of The Mandalorian, when Din Djarin is swinging around a lightsaber and he cuts his own leg. This is, like, I don't mind it, but I'm like, okay, now this is just changing hands again. The problem is, this doesn't go later on where it's supposed to go. And so, watching it in retrospect, whatever.
Yeah. Are we supposed to believe that Han's never fired Chewie's bowcaster?
Yeah, it's a Trivial Pursuit question.
Yeah, this is bullshit with the amount of years they've been together.
It's a joke, because it was literally a Trivial Pursuit question.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Did you get it right?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. How many times has Chewie's bowcaster ever been fired in the movies? Once. It was by Chewie.
It was by Chewie.
So, I think it's funny.
Finn's called a traitor, and I've never seen a stormtrooper with these weapons that Grievous's men had. But, okay.
Take a shot every time the word traitor is fucking yelled in this film. One, do you really, you could recognize this dude from across the freaking patio with a battle going on? Whatever.
Yeah, especially and then, because they don't take their helmets off usually. They're not supposed
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
No. And then the dude throws his weapons away to bust up his freaking light bright fucking stick. I said my point last time about that fucking thing.
Oh, by the way, Poe's back. Remember him? He's taking out TIE fighters and stormtroopers as Finn gets the saber back.
This looks amazing.
It does.
When those TIE fighters, when it does that Apocalypse Now with the sunset, astounding shot. But the X-Wing over the water,
yeah.
This is beautiful.
Yeah, this is stuff from the trailer, too. I will say, though, I think the scene of action, I think the camera's moving around too damn much. I'm not really into this action.
It's just fine. Like, I don't think JJ's strength is action at all. So yeah, that's just kind of my summation. And honestly, like, this is just, we're killing time. We have to find a way to get Rey captured.
Yeah.
So the bad guys have to show up here. I don't remember, did they ever explain how Kylo Ren knows they're on that planet?
No.
You had the hot chick go out and release the message to the First Order.
Oh, okay. She
that
okay.
found the droid.
Oh, that's right. But damn, they move really fast then, because they got there.
Really quick.
They got there in the span of 5 minutes.
Meanwhile, Rey's in the forest and runs into Kylo, who captures her. Finn sees Rey getting loaded onto the ship, but Han doesn't want to hear it, as we see the re-entry of Leia and C-3PO, complete with the red arm.
Damn it, 3PO.
What's the red arm for?
Better story for another time.
Yeah, there was a whole thing associated with that, I remember. Yeah.
They do a comic series to explain the red arm.
Yeah.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yep, serious.
All right, so Han and Leia. Now, the chemistry isn't nearly as good as it was, but I do think that it's still good. I think it's fun seeing these two on screen together, and I like the comments on her hair and his jacket as he tells her that he's seen their son, and this is actually a really good scene between them. It is kind of sad to see Carrie Fisher like this, because she was so young and vibrant in that first trilogy. Obviously, she had quite a life leading up to this. Unfortunately, this is her last complete role in this series. Well, no, she's back in The Last Jedi, but I'm saying she died halfway through that production.
Right. Yeah, but she at least finished
the movie. She finished the movie, but what I'm saying is, you know, she's here for the press junket for this, and it was fun seeing her talk about being back and whatnot. I like seeing her back. I was scared of seeing her back, but once she gets on screen, I think the charm of it outweighs the bad.
I don't think she's very good, but I just think part of it's because of the life she had lived, as you mentioned. She does still feel like Leia, especially when she's with Han, but I don't like that. What is Leia doing 30 years later? She's leading the Resistance again. You couldn't come up with anything more interesting than just bringing her back to the status quo, and I hate I saw our son. Just say Ben, for God's sake. That's how, I'm deathly serious, that's how they would be called.
I have an issue with Carrie Fisher. I know a lot of people complained. I think she's fine in this, but you know what? I also have a lot of experience seeing her do roasts and discussions and stuff, so I've seen her through the years, you know, so I like seeing older Carrie Fisher. I appreciate what she's done to Hollywood. People only knew the scores of scripts and stuff she's done. Maybe, you know, they would have respected her more. They want 22-year-old woman in a gold bikini. Guess what? Grow the fuck up. But I like these two when they're together. I like when she walks out. 3PO, I could kick in the frickin' throat. I don't need that moment interrupted. That is the worst frickin' spot for a little frickin' joke right there. But then I like these two together. I do feel that Han and Leia back together is an impertinent moment. I think it matters. But I don't understand how long Kylo's, for somebody that looks like he's 25, when did he leave Luke? How long has he been building this order? The time certainly doesn't match up.
Yeah, because he would have had to turn on Luke, join the First Order, and then did the First Order rise to power before or after he joined them? These are the questions you have to ask, because the movie doesn't bother to explain it.
What would have been a nice thing to do with General Leia is to have her take Mon Mothma's part, that she's leading the New Republic, and the New Republic has become so ineffectual that Han is off leading the rebellion. You could have had something that way, where they're at odds by trying different ways to stop what's going on. But I'm so glad that they got her back as well, because I think she was a bigger question than Mark.
Well, her writing's out there for everyone to see. If you want to see some great writing, watch those prequels, because she did a lot of rewrites on those. I'm just kidding. She's been a script doctor for years and years, and she's touched up a lot of scripts in Hollywood. Look up her resume, because you'd be surprised by what she's had a hand in writing.
She basically found a second career, much like Mark Hamill did with voice.
Yeah, she did. She wrote a ton of novels and stuff over the years, and she made something of herself for sure. One thing that you touched on, Adam, that I have to say, you know, yeah, 3PO interrupting is annoying, but by the way, he's always been that way. He's always done that. Remember when they had the kiss on the Falcon? Here comes 3PO to say, he fixed the capacitor. He had a way of interrupting throughout the years, so I think this is no different.
I just don't like that Leia and Han kept him around and didn't just sell him for scrap as soon as Return of the Jedi was over, because his purpose is no longer needed. Your services are no longer required, and poor R2-D2.
Oh, God.
That was my question. I was like, alright, there's 3PO. Where's the other half?
Yep.
And the other character, I'm like, okay, no mention of Lando?
Okay, so they look at the map as BB-8 unveils R2, who apparently has been pouting since Luke disappeared. He doesn't look as messed up as, say, when he was on Dagobah. You know, he looks pretty clean, but for some reason, he just hasn't moved. He's sad.
He should be like, I want nothing to do with Luke, because every time I'm with him, I get shot.
Swallowed.
I get dirty. Yes. I watch people get stabbed, as we find out in the next movie, and the house burned down. Like, that guy leaves death and destruction everywhere he goes.
Leia and Han, they talk about Ren, and they reveal that they went back to what they knew, which is why they lost their son. Rey wakes up in constraints as Ren takes off his mask and asks her to tell him about the droid. She keeps resisting as he gets inside her head. She reveals his insecurity that he's afraid of being inferior to Vader. As Rey is constrained, she somehow convinces Daniel Craig to free her.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
That's the stormtrooper.
That's the stormtrooper.
It's
yeah.
Daniel Craig under mask.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he called JJ and JJ put him in.
And he's literally TK007.
Yeah.
Oh, they should have called him PPK007.
Okay, let's talk about this. So if there's one thing we've learned about the Force, it's that it needs to be harnessed and studied and controlled. Yet this broad somehow, after not revealing a thing about her origin, knows how to do this kind of thing when Luke spent how long studying with Yoda in Empire Strikes Back? This is the kind of shit that just left me so cold towards this movie when I walked out of it in theaters initially. Oh, I hate how she just knows the Force and she can use it like this. It's fucking ridiculous. JJ's like, okay, we're going to put away everything that George did because people don't want that, so we're just going to make her be all-powerful with this Force.
I don't see it that way, but the reason is Kylo did study for years, and he's a little bitch with the Force.
Correct, but at least he studied.
He studied, but he's a little bitch with the Force.
Yeah, he is.
I do see them as complete opposites, like, I don't know, yin and yang twins. They should be against one another. I hear you. I never bump up against it at this point that she's able to use the mind, the trick of the Force, and fight back Kylo Ren's mind rape as he's trying to do. Like, I don't bump up against it at all.
I'm more so with Garrett as far as every other, even Anakin, who is supposed to be, if you believe in the prophecy, the most powerful Force wielder that they've ever seen. He didn't start harnessing the Force until he was training with Obi-Wan. Like, it's not like he, when he was 8 years old, was like Carrie, being able to move stuff with his mind. I don't like that she knows how to use the mind trick. All the stuff we take for granted with the Jedi, she can do at the drop of the hat. So I do have that huge problem with her being so overly powerful, but I didn't think they were twins. I thought the reveal was she would be the cousin, Luke's daughter. That's where I thought they were going. If she was going to be related to somebody, I thought they were going to reveal that at the end of this movie. That was going to be the lead-in. That she was either Luke's daughter, or the other one was she was Obi-Wan's daughter. I don't know how that would have worked, because unless you've seen Clone Wars or Rebels, you don't know that Obi-Wan's actually been in a relationship with somebody.
I think that guy's a virgin when he dies, honestly. We've never seen that thing.
How did people watch Clone Wars?
Nah.
That scene, just like Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, I do think she does some of this with ease, to where it makes the Jedi look even dumber that they spend so much time training for stuff that you can do so quickly.
Starkiller is recharging. Get it, guys? Starkiller, because that was going to be Skywalker's originally name.
Well, that's also the Force Unleashed video game.
Yeah, it's recharging as we learn that it's bigger and more powerful than the Death Star.
I am so glad they give Harrison Ford the line to call it out.
Yeah.
So I am so glad that he's at least like, are you fucking serious?
How do we blow it up?
But there's always a way to blow it. He's like, in Armageddon. He's like Bruce Willis. Just blow the shit up. There's a bunch of you guys just thinking shit up. Like, he's over.
Another JJ involvement, because he wrote that script. And then, by the way, we get an Admiral Ackbar sighting here. So, nice seeing him again. Finn says that he can disable the shields, he just needs to get there. Finn and Poe, they acknowledge each other as they walk by. And I think this is one of those scenes that you were talking about, Adam, where they just kind of kept filming and these guys just kind of...
I swear to God, these guys must have watched Top Gun before.
It looked exactly like it. Yeah. I thought of that too.
There's so much of
the volleyball scene.
Yeah, there's so much of the looks that they give each other, and they're on the field, so to speak. All we needed is that Berlin song to start playing through R2-D2's speakers.
And then we see Han and Leia have another moment saying that not all their relationship was bad. She then says that if he sees their son, she wants Han to promise her that he'll bring him home.
Call him Ben.
You know what? I have Ben written in my notes, but I say son just because I know it pisses you off.
And I get Ben for the sake of Obi-Wan, but he only helped up to a point.
Yeah.
And if anything, if I'm Leia, I'm like, oh, the guy who left my father for dead, baby.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And basically gave Luke the scout handbook of, oh yeah, here's all the basic shit. I'm going to pass you off to Yoda because I'm going to go sit on a log and enjoy my ghost life. She should be like, fuck that guy. But they did that because that was his name in the books. And someone was trying to spin Rey as like an anagram for Mara Jade, and I'm like, there's no way you can do that, because then you would hear George Lucas yell no like Darth Vader at the end of Revenge of the Sith. And there's that great clip of someone brings it up and he like throws a book across the room or something.
I was at that screening. I could have sworn I heard a long no at that screening. Could have been him. And if I didn't like the light speed used earlier when they take off, I hate that they use light speed and then they just land.
How do you do the same thing a second time?
I know!
Like that. Wow.
Kylo.
And it also doesn't make any sense. Taking off light speed, I don't like it. I could justify it. Landing at light speed? I know we're talking about space wizards and laser swords, but it's an impossibility.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's just it. Yeah, Star Wars has always been, and Matt, you were the first to point this out, it's not science fiction, it's all fantasy.
It's space fantasy.
It's space fantasy, yeah. So I can take this stuff to a point, but come on. This was established earlier in the series that you can't do this. But you can, for convenience sake, in this Disney Star Wars film.
Yeah, well, they like Star Trek, they can do this.
Yeah. So he's taking what he did, even though he didn't want to do what he did. He's doing what he wants to do, but he's going back to what he did.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Kylo senses the presence of Han, as Finn reveals that his job while here was in sanitation, and his one goal when he got here was to get Rey.
They stole this joke, by the way, from Tropic Thunder. That is a direct line. When Danny McBride and Nick Nolte are tied up, because Nick Nolte is like the veteran they based the movie on, and he goes, yeah, I worked Coast Guard. There's a pause. He goes, sanitation department.
They cribbed from a seven-year-old movie at the time this was made.
And also, J.J. told Kevin Smith that it was a nod to Clerks.
Oh, my God.
When he talks about stormtroopers knowing how to unclog
sewer
mains.
Oh, my God. Rey makes her way further into the base as Finn makes Phasma lower the shields, and I do like how Han recommends that they take her to the garbage chute as a kind of revenge for what happened to him before. This was fun stuff.
That makes me laugh, yeah. But why I turn against Finn, not just in this movie, but for the entire series, is him with Phasma right here. Who's in charge now, Phasma? Huh? Who's the boss? Who's the boss? Are you kidding? Like,
you
how
fucking,
is that?
Yeah.
How is that not a fucking blooper? Was that put in by accident? That is... Holy shit.
Well, he wouldn't be the master of this, though. Like, this wouldn't be his forte. So I can kind of get that he would be off-kilter with this. I have no problems with this. The ships make their way to Starkiller. As Poe says, as long as there's light, they have a chance against it.
So the minute it gets dark out, all right, we got to go back home.
It's like a fucking werewolf.
Well, they forgot to install headlights on the X-Wings.
You know what? This finally addresses something that I've always railed against. At least when we go from light to dark in the span of one scene, it's got a reason.
Yeah, that's a good point. So as Finn tries coming up with a plan to get Rey, they spot her, and the fight at Starkiller rages on. You know, people can say all they want about what Lucas did with Phantom Menace, but one thing all three of us said on that particular podcast was he juggled those three action scenes in that final act very well. Abrams is having a really hard time doing that here, especially when it comes to this next scene, which is the death of one of cinema's most beloved characters. He cannot juggle these action scenes.
No, he can't. And the thing is, separately, they're done decently enough. But when you try to intertwine it, it takes it away. I really enjoy the space battle here. I think getting in the X-Wings and then seeing the enemy ships deploy, I love the space battle. Though, I don't know why the Republic rebellion, fucking Resistance, that's it. Damn it. Why the Resistance doesn't have bombers, since they have X-Wings. Mm. You know, you think they'd have some Y-Wings here. I like the space battle so much that every time we go back inside Starkiller Base, the action, the momentum is sapped away.
So, as Han is setting up the chargers to blow up the system, Kylo finds him. Now, I like the cyclical nature of how the only reason Han stays and talks to him is because he promised Leia that he would bring him home. I think that's great. I liked Han calling him Ben. Matt, something you've been railing against this entire podcast. That was great. And how William stops the music for this scene. I think all of that worked. I just wish the scene had more weight. And the location of the death, a platform in the middle of nowhere with no handlebars, makes zero fucking sense.
I never thought about the handrails. Oh my
God.
OSHA would not put up with this.
No! This would not get past.
Well, it's consistent, like in A New Hope, the guys that are monitoring the Death Star.
That's
like,
true.
There's no rail.
That's
there.
A good point, too. But come on, you're not going to meet up with somebody out on this thing without anything to hold on to. You got to balance yourself out there. I don't know. This did get out. I was fortunate where I saw it without knowing about this. Although, as you mentioned, Adam, as soon as he comes on screen, you know that he's going to die in this film. This death just really didn't have any impact on me, and it should because I love this character so much.
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't when I watch it, and it depends on my mood. I was spoiled about 10 minutes before I walked into the movie theater.
Oh, fuck off.
Yep. Somebody posted the picture in a random group.
I saw that same thing.
Yep. Just random groups, random pages. It'd be like in the comment section of a news site. It was just a picture of Han Solo with a blade through him.
Oh, fuck off.
So I knew it was coming. I think the issue where the emotion doesn't land for me is we don't have a relationship between these two. I'm told he's his son, I'm told he's his father. We never have a relationship, so to have the patricide here doesn't have the impact that it would if we had a movie of them together and falling apart. I knew it was coming. I say, sometimes this scene lands for me a little better. I don't think it's ever great, however. But I do think from this moment on, Kylo Ren is and should be irredeemable. Yes.
I have the same problem, not just with the architecture of this railing, but I don't think this has the weight it should because did he spend more time with Luke than he did Han? That's certainly possible, given Han's like a gambling addiction that goes back to smuggling.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I think the lack of a real fleshed out backstory hurts this almost as much as I'm sure Han felt that sword going through his chest. As obvious as this was, I didn't have the thing that I had when I watched Captain Kirk get crushed by a bridge. I just felt sadness. This, I thought, was a very surprisingly earned death scene for a character I really did not want to see come back.
I don't think Ford wanted to come back either. Not to mention, Abrams holds the beat of Ren doing it far too long, and I just hated the shot of Han falling off this platform. I wish...
I'm okay with never having a body to bring back. I know that a lot of people's issue is him just, like, falling into the abyss, but I think without that, you'd have to have a funeral or something, and just let him go.
Or at least they kept the blaster somehow.
Yeah. The only thing that does work about it, to me, is Chewie's reaction, which involves setting off the charges. This is great.
Oh, yeah, and he fucking shoots Kylo Ren in the...
Uh-huh.
Which is why I wanted Episode 8 to just be Man on Fire starring Chewbacca. He has the appropriate reaction of just losing his shit,
yeah.
Which we have not seen Chewbacca do really since Empire for like one scene, but I feel like you could have really utilized Chewbacca more than they did since he's got no one left. His actual family's long dead.
Yeah, Lumpy's done.
That same bowcaster freaking threw somebody like 10 meters when they shot him, but here Kylo just, merely a flesh wound. The leg's cut off. No, it's not. The symbolism of the star running out, literally we are plunged into darkness when Kylo turns over to the dark.
I refuse to use those two words about a J.J. Abrams movie.
Plunged into the darkness.
I don't want to fucking hear that.
Not till next year. No, I'm with you on that, Adam. I do like the symbolism behind that as well. We then cut to the fight between Ren and Rey, with Finn being the first. Look, I like it being in the snow. But the idea of Finn wielding this lightsaber again, it doesn't make any sense to me. And just takes a whole lot of magic behind these lightsabers completely away. Especially when Rey, again, shows up that can make the saber come to her again. God, this final third act is a mess.
So the Finn part, I do like how he acts the way you should if a Sith is charging at you. He's like, oh shit, I'm fucked. And he gets overmatched very easily. So I appreciate that they treat a non-force user utilizing a lightsaber much differently than a somewhat trained force user. But I agree, the lightsaber flying into her hand is such bullshit. I thought this was going to be the big Luke introduction.
Yeah, me too.
That lightsaber flies into his hand and this is when you see him. Which I think would have gotten a louder reaction than people clapped when she grabbed the lightsaber. I'm like, why? She has no fucking context with this weapon. Mm-hmm. Just because she's the, you know, the most powerful thing in the galaxy now?
One, can we admit that at least that freaking Finn gets a kill shot on himself?
Oh yeah, like, he should be fucking dead.
We have seen that type of shot in so many samurai movies, which is what is taking that back lancing across the back. Mm-hmm. Like, he should be split and done. And I was okay with it, because I'm like, oh my god, they killed him. What a bold move. No, I still like Rey getting that lightsaber out of the air. And maybe it's because that theater that I was in did cheer loudly, and I got a daughter and wife that are pumping fists, but I didn't have an issue with it as much as my mind tells me I should. The music swells. Did I think it was going to be Luke? I did. I thought, obviously, he was going to pop out, so I didn't expect it. What I noticed this time, and it's funny, because I was watching the scene in my living room, and my daughter Madison came in. I go, here, watch this, watch this. There's no way this was planned. But Rey fights with an aggression that the Jedi would never fight mm-hmm. with. Like, she's got an anger. She's doing the stabby motion we see in Revenge of the Sith from Palpatine behind his desk, using it like a, you know, like a dagger. And I thought, at the end of this fight, I thought she'd cut Kylo's head off. Because there's a shot, that saber goes directly horizontal, and I guess it just glances off his shoulder, but I thought she took his head off. And I thought we were about to see the next Sith Lord rise with Rey here at the end of this film.
They fight in the snow as Starkiller is still getting attacked, and Poe says, hit the target with everything you got! So we have another trench run. Check.
Yeah.
Now, as much as I hate what led up to it. I do like the fight between Rey and Kylo and how Kylo is saying that he can show her the correct ways of using the Force, though she can already do it all, obviously.
Yeah, it's like, why do I need training? I'm doing just fine.
Yeah, exactly. Though the planet is being taken out, so they both decide it's time to leave. As Snoke says, it's time to complete Kylo's training.
Why didn't you do this sooner?
No shit.
Completed by who?
Yeah.
I thought this was going to be like we were going to find out Snoke had a mask.
Uh-huh.
And it was actually going to be Palpatine.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think this fight is good. I like the way they use the lighting with the lightsabers and the darkness kind of evoking Return of the Jedi. But I thought for sure you were going to see that fucking green Luke lightsaber to save the day. And I was shocked he didn't show up because I thought this was they were saving it for here.
That would have been awesome. You know, I didn't even think about that, guys. Honestly, I never thought about Luke's green lightsaber on this white snow, but God, that would have been awesome.
You have him yell Ben the same way that Han
did. Uh-huh. The Falcon picks up Rey and Finn as Starkiller blows up.
Okay, this is also dumb. If you were going to have this, at least carry it through the entire trilogy.
No, you can't have the same one, because you got to have some closure on it.
Fucking built it in Jedi.
I know, but they killed it then, too. They killed it in New Hope, and they blew it up in Jedi. You had to fucking get rid of this thing in this movie if you're going to do it.
Please keep something around.
Oh, they keep things around, just not things I wanted.
Amazing that this thing, it implodes and turns back into the sun that it just sucked the energy out of.
We cut to Finn being taken away as Rey walks right past Chewie. Oh, I'm sorry, Leia walks right past Chewie.
No, that's the one. She goes right to Rey, and I audibly said, like, bullshit under my
breath. Yeah, JJ did admit that this was a mistake on his part later on, which I completely agree with. People made up the excuse of, oh, she knows that Chewie is grieving. Bullshit. This was a fucking production flaw. R2 revs back up as BB-8 has a buddy, and 3PO has his friend back.
Talk about two characters that are going to fuck.
3PO says R2 has what they need, as the map is now complete. So it's been an R2 this entire time?
I'm like, so if you have a missing part on a map, guess what? Just go search the missing part.
Exactly.
Yeah, or hack R2-D2.
No shit.
Because clearly they know he's been with Luke.
And here's something we haven't mentioned, guys, is how weird is it that this fucking MacGuffin is a map to where Luke is? So silly.
Yeah, especially because, like, if you search the galaxy with the resistance you have, which is decent, all things considered, I'm sure you could have found
exactly.
There's only so many planets in the galaxy, especially since half of them have the same fucking climate as other ones.
Or since it's going to affect the entire New Republic, I'm sure the New Republic itself might be interested in the Jedi coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And, gee, what did you search the planet that Luke started his new Jedi Academy on? It's not like, as we find out, he didn't change planets!
Rey stays by Finn, saying that they will see each other again, as she thanks him and then leaves. Leia tells Rey, may the Force be with you, as her and Chewie get in the Falcon and head to where the map leads them. And this final shot with Rey and Luke, this was the one time in this movie I got chills. One, I think Hamill looks badass with that beard and that hood that he has on. Two, it's such a moment of her holding out that saber to him. There's so much history behind it. I think all of this is cool. And it's also the one time Williams' new themes work. I think the theme that Williams uses as she's walking up these steps is pretty remarkable. It's quite a remarkable shot to end on. Too bad they went further with a helicopter shot, which I don't like. But this was a pretty cool scene to end on.
It's amazing because this final part almost ends, it feels like a mid-credit type of stinger. The iconography, the shots are beautiful here on this vista. The music is great, and you're waiting, you're waiting, you're waiting. And you don't know, is he going to be dead? You know, you don't know what you're going to find here. Is she going to find a grave? And that's actually what I thought. I thought it was going to be just a grave of Luke gone, or just a hand, you know, his metal hand. So I think the end works. I get pissed when I think about it, though, that it's nothing but J.J. Abrams' frickin', let's call it a Snoke monster puzzle box, because it's just like, wait till next time. But I think it's captivating because the shot and the music work so beautifully. And it's the one time we get Daisy Ridley showing that she does have the ability to act, because I think there's some yearning she's really putting out of her
face. Oh, I think she's done pretty good this entire film, considering. I have no real issues with her acting in this.
So this is also literally J.J. passing the baton to the next director.
Mm-hmm.
So that's literal. It's also the best acting Mark Hamill has ever done in a live-action movie.
With a two-second shot?
True.
Because he looks, like, legitimately broken.
Yeah.
He's like, I did not expect anybody he probably hasn't seen a living person, like a human, in God knows how long. It made me curious. The character I wanted to see, he made me wait till the very end, and it ends on literally a cliffhanger because they're on the side of a cliff.
I didn't even think about that.
I thought, all things considered, this was a cool way to end the movie. And I'm like, okay, Mark Hamill actually, he looks good for his age, and he got himself in good shape, all things considered. It left me wanting more, which I did not think this movie was going to do.
It just blows my mind that this is the final shot of the film, and Mark Hamill is second billed. This is one shot.
Second highest paid,
yes.
Too.
Oh, my other thought was, you know, she gets to the island, Luke is not there. You hear Palpatine's laugh, and you cut the credit.
That would have been too much, though.
I thought that was what, he's back.
Mm-hmm. All right. Wow. Long animated discussion. Our first of many about these Disney Star Wars films. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give The Force Awakens? Adam, go ahead, sir.
This was one I posted when I was getting ready to see this. You know, I get to take my children to see Star Wars in a theater, like my father before me. My anticipation for this was huge, not just for me, but I have children and a wife who got to see in theaters for the first time, and that was big. We got an entire new cast of characters. We got a new studio putting it out. We got a new director, new writer. Everything was new about it. And for that, this movie is a lot of the same. We discuss it. It rehashes story basically from A New Hope. And I remember that discussion. Everybody's like, it's A New Hope, but it's shinier and bigger. That's not a false assessment. I mean, it's true. And like it or not, that is what this movie is. But I'm going to say, this movie looks great. Like, it is shot amazingly well. I think the action, for the most part, is stunning every time we get it. The new characters, I like our new characters, Rey and Finn and Poe. Poe has become one of my favorite characters in Star Wars, amazingly enough. I think Finn, though, I think he wears out his welcome pretty quick. I think Hux is a caricature of a military leader. The score is nice when it's everything that came before, but the rest of it is pretty dang bland. This is kind of, it's weird if you were going to start a new franchise that you did it just by rehashing so much of the past, but those are some of the best parts of this movie. It's enjoyable, but sadly not for the story parts of it. It leaves so much more to be desired, and that was the purpose of it, works and doesn't at the same time, because you still need to be fulfilling while you tease what's coming next. The last shot works because I do want to know what happens, but then you tell me it's going to be a long time to wait till I get there, and you're giving me another movie in the meantime. So you're breaking it up in a way that I think hurt Star Wars in a big way. Overall, though, I think this sits kind of the higher mid-tier of Star Wars. I think it's better than most of the prequels, and I'll save where I think it fits in this later trilogy until we're finished with those, but when I watch it, and we beat this movie up pretty good here, I enjoy it when I watch it. I enjoy it more when I watch it with my family in a big crowd. I'm giving this movie a 7 because even with my problems, I enjoy the energy when I watch this film.
All right. 7 out of 10 from Adam. Matt?
I would equate The Force Awakens to a really good cheeseburger from Five Guys, where if I want a cheeseburger, it's not going to be my first choice, but you could do far worse when it comes to hamburgers, certainly. Look outside your window or off your highway. You can find worse places than Five Guys. In fact, you can find several of them. At the same time, it inspires me to want something a little bit more elegant. Like, I think of, don't evoke A New Hope so much when it's my favorite movie in the saga up to this point. In my head, it's not comparable, despite hitting so many of the same beats. But I'll give the movie this. It's eminently watchable. For something I've not seen in a long time, I enjoyed myself quite a bit, for the most part. I think once you get to the last third, when everything has to converge, I don't think JJ is especially good at that as a storyteller, of balancing multiple balls, but it certainly put me back in the Star Wars headspace, which I give a huge compliment to, because it's not something I expected or, for that matter, wanted. As a reintroduction, I think this accomplishes its job. Do I think it's a revolutionary movie? No, and I actually don't think it has the staying power for something that made over $2 billion. I'm not going to say it came and went, but I think the other movies in this series, certainly under Disney, have warranted more discussion. And I don't know exactly why. I have thoughts on all the other instances, but for something that was highly anticipated, I don't think it was not 100% worth it for me. I would have liked something a little bit more substance and a little bit more to contemplate. But it's a good movie. I don't think it's bad. Of all the movies we've covered, this is somewhere in the middle. I'd put it maybe slightly above Return of the Jedi if you force me to pick. So I'll give it a 6 on 10, like a good 6.
Solid 6 from Goudreau. You know, this was the Star Wars movie that, from the time it was announced, I was a part of Disney up until about 6 months before it actually was released. I had so many thoughts about it when I left the theater saying, oh God, I don't feel nearly as amazed as I thought I would coming out of a Star Wars movie. Because, I mean, in the lead up to it, I would post how many days were left until then. I was really, really excited for this movie. And when it ended, I just looked at my friend and I was just like, it's just a movie. And yeah, it is just a movie, but what I was shocked at when I sat down to watch it for this particular podcast, because I hadn't seen it in probably close to 6-7 years, I was taken by how much I was enjoying the first half of this movie and how much I was enjoying being brought back to this world by Abrams and the writers and everybody involved with the production, including Williams, who, again, when he invokes the old themes, his music works. But once she goes down and grabs that fucking lightsaber, this movie takes a turn that it never recovers from. And Matt, you hit a lot of your points I was going to hit as well. I don't think Abrams knows how to wrap these things up. When it's a broader scale, on a broader picture, he does not know how to put it in a bow and wrap it up. Yes, you needed to kill the Starkiller planet, but why was the Starkiller planet there to begin with? All you're doing is rehashing what you've done before. And I get, that was the point of this film. This was kind of the birth of those legacy sequels we saw, you know, once Halloween and things started coming out. And yeah, J.J. did it with Star Trek as well, where, you know, we saw Spock in that movie. And I think a lot of his nature works in this movie. A lot of his filmmaking sensibilities work. But once we get to the conclusion and he has to wrap it up, it doesn't work. So many things that I had questions about. And honestly, I had a decent enough time watching this. I was shocked by how much I did enjoy watching this. But it's still not in the upper tier. I think Revenge of the Sith is better than this. I think all three of the original trilogy are better than this. I would, again, hold it to the middle tier of Star Wars up until this point, and we'll talk about the further sequels when we get to them. But for me, I have the same exact score written down as Matt. I have a 6 out of 10. It was enjoyable enough to be brought back in, but once we had the exit, it left a lot to be desired. And I understand that was the way movies were being made in 2015, from the time Marvel was building their new stories upon the next movie. You wanted to build up to the next movie, and I get that, but when you're trying to build up, Abrams can build it up really well, but when it comes to concluding it, no, he's not the best. But still, solid enough movie, 6 out of 10 for me. So, not long after this was announced, we were hearing that there was going to be a Star Wars movie every year for the next 10 years is what they initially announced, starting with the next film that we're going to discuss next week, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. This was a side story. It was something that was not going to be a part of the Skywalker saga. It's going to be its own thing. Adam, what were you feeling when they announced Rogue One was going to be released the very next year?
I was excited, and I liked this idea, because I felt like we really needed to get away from the Skywalker family. I've had enough, even with this one, I had enough. I'd like to do something else. It's a big freaking galaxy, and we're in a very small part of it. So I liked the idea, even though it's a big part of the Star Wars, the Skywalker saga, but the books that I read, Wraith Squadron and Rogue Squadron, like just the military aspect, I was all about. So I was looking forward to this quite a bit, even all the way up to release. It was just, felt like it was down, it was dirty, it wasn't about Jedi and laser swords, it was just about military tactics that got us those plans, and I liked that idea.
So I had similar thoughts to Adam, where I was like, thank God, a Star Wars movie without the Force and lightsabers. And thank God we're getting a spinoff. That was kind of my thought. I said, if you were going to do Star Wars one a year, I'd like to see stuff that's really disconnected from what we've seen before. And when this was announced, I kind of thought that's what it was going to be. So I was on board. I really liked the director choice. I think I'm one of the bigger defenders of Godzilla 2014. Who knows if we'll talk about that someday. So I was excited about this. More than I thought I would be. In fact, I was probably more excited for that than I was for Force Awakens.
I know a lot of people are like you. They felt the same exact way. I'm not going to give a big build-up as to what I was thinking coming into this. All I'll say is this. Matt, when we were at the former place, we would do our own thing, and yeah, there were things posted about us. We would go on the actual main show of that site, and we get questioned on our opinions and whatnot, and they were all tongue-in-cheek. Once it came to this movie, this was kind of the demarcation point where people either loved or hated me, and my thoughts about the lead-up to this and the actual film itself is really what just drew the line between those two factions of people. And I kind of had to live down to that ever since. And that's what I will leave it at, because when I get to watch this movie, I'm just going to leave it at that. So, yeah, tune in next week for our review of Rogue One. Boys, this has been a long Force Awakens review. I appreciate you guys coming on. One down, five to go. So far, we all have our limbs. But who knows, by the time this series is over, we might not. Until next week, when we talk Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. That podcast, it belongs to me. Thank you, gentlemen.
People are counting on us. The galaxy is counting on us.
Solo, we'll figure it out.
We'll use the Force. That's not how the Force works. Oh, really? You're cold? Come on.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Did you see that? Outside!
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
I know what I have to do, but I don't know if I have the strength to do it.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
You, the scavenger.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts. Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
General Hux, is it the Resistance pilot?
Yes. And he had help from one of our own.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
I can fix this!
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
My men are exceptionally trained, programmed from birth.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
No prior signs of nonconformity.
This was his first offense.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual, Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
What'd you do?
I bypassed the compressor.
Huh.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such. Freeman and a Retrospective Podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
Leading them to the Last Jedi.
So do we put the boxing gloves on now or after we hit record?
I want to say, for the record, before this series of, five films start, I like you all, I love you all, and I appreciate you, and nothing is personal. I feel like these are going to be like the end of fucking Rocky 3.
Same.
We'll read that Same. Bill.
It's going to be shut up, fool, for 2 hours.
I'll put it as a blueprint. I'm not going to say it on the airwaves, though. Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Let me restart that again since Adam sent a message. Okay. And I got to turn off the sound on my phone.
I'm not big on J.J. one way or the other. I've not seen Super 8. What else did he do? Was it Lost? I
Mission never saw Lost. Mission Impossible 3 was his first movie.
And that one, yeah, he did the best Mission Impossible movie in that entire series. So, spoiler for my thoughts. So,
oh, boy. God damn. You said two things in the last 3 minutes that we're going to be covering in the next couple of years, and I'm sure Matt's going to beat your ass more than you're going to beat us.
We're going to start arguing about stuff that's not even involved.
I know. So, Star Trek and Mission Impossible. All right.
So I was not against it. It wasn't as long as it was between Revenge of the Sith and this, but it sure as hell felt, or between Return of the Jedi and Phantom Menace.
Matt, I know you're not big on music. Adam, how do you feel about Williams' score in this? Or is he on? He's on mute. He must be away from the mic. Oh, there he is.
I think when I expected Wedge to be here, because when you talk about the best pilot in the Resistance, sorry, am I bitching that already?
Well, I just bitched my First Order, so go ahead.
There's two choices you have.
The Falcon then moves into a Star Destroyer, or no, it moves into the ship that Han's driving, right?
Yeah.
No. We're talking about
the Star Destroyer on Jakku.
We're talking about the scene, yeah. All right, let me get to it. So the Falcon moves into a Star Destroyer as Finn takes out the last TIE fighter. Remember how I told you guys I was really tired and I fell asleep during Force Awakens, and I was taking my notes. This is around the time I fell asleep, so I got to kind of outline these here.
Initially, I was like, oh, man, Calista had to talk him into going back to work. And I thought we were going to get a work. That's Calista Flockhart, Ally McBeal, his wife, for those for those that are like, what?
Sorry for stealing your thunder, but that's where my brain went. Because I would have cut this whole sequence.
Yeah, me too.
Not only did Matt hit my point that this just looks like they got a hentai fetish, he even brought up the Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which was in my notes. Because these look like the creature they fight at the beginning of that.
Sorry, apparently I threw it to the wrong person. I apologize.
That's great. I'm glad we see it that way. Everything that happens here once they get into this weird...
They then land on planet Takadana? Chakadana?
This one I don't remember.
Chakadana? Want to say it's Takadana?
Takadana.
And I know that from Battlefront 2.
They then land on planet Takadana.
So I see a lot of the same beats, but I see enough differences, and I see some really cool stuff that I'm enjoying. Are there some same beats? JJ told Kevin Smith that it was a nod to Clerks.
Oh my god.
When he talks about stormtroopers knowing how to unclog
sewer
mains. Oh
my god.
So you're saying that Han should have gone to Lands, and how many fucking dicks did you suck, Nicholas?
Well, that battle outside Maz's temple, one of the stormtrooper voices you hear is Kevin Smith. He put him in an ADR booth to have him voice one of them.
You know, I think he did that just to get him to shut up and not say a goddamn word after he left the set, because I know there was a fucking big Order 66 done on people who said stuff when they left the set.
He got to tour Batman Forever and Force Awakens.
Yeah.
The guy who made Clerks, like, it's
yeah,
blows your mind.
Just let him go.
Or at least they kept the blaster somehow.
Yeah, yeah, good point. The only thing, go ahead. Somebody was going to say this, okay.